Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 385 of Roguecast, recorded September 13th, 2022. What's the most you've ever lost in a space coin toss?
All right, we're podcasting.
Yes?
Yes.
We podcast last week, right?
We did.
We did.
Yeah, we're back.
We're back.
Don't make too much of a thing out of it. We have a lot of stuff, I think, to cover this
time. We do. D23 happened, and I think that was a lot of it, and we'll get to that.
Just remind me, that's like Disney announcing just all its things?
Annual shareholders get excited about this thing.
Yeah, but it's also like, isn't it an event? Don't people go to it or something?
People do. A lot of them are sort of entertainment people, yeah. I think.
So this is like a big entertainment people party. This is not something that for like peons can get into, like, Comic-Con.
There's
always a crowd of people, so I feel like it's got a little bit of, like, San Diego Comic-Con vibe.
A little bit, but this is definitely kind of amp people up for
upcoming
stuff.
I guess since Disney owns 80 properties that are big, nerdy properties.
Why is it called D23?
I don't know. I don't know what 23
is. Because of the 23 countries that they own outright?
It is their 23 members on the Secret Illuminati.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
It was D20, and then they bought Fox, and they got their three Illuminati members.
I'm sure it is something like the whole, it's like an Illuminati kind of chaos thing.
It probably is. It's the 23 secret signs that will bring about the return of
There's weird
Walt
stuff
Disney.
Out there. Explain to me why the KFC Twitter account only follows 11 people, some of them named Herb.
And the other one named Spice.
And the other are former members of the Spice Girls.
Yeah.
It's weird.
That's delightful.
That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, store news. We did get some big stocks. We got a big dice restock, including dice bags. We got a
statue restock.
Big statue restock.
Yes, we did.
We got an order in.
We're still recovering from it.
Yeah. We got an order from USAopoly, who do Marvel Dice Throne. So we got all the Marvel Dice Throne in now. They've got the game Disney Sorcerer's Arena. It's like the miniatures battle for Disney.
Yeah. I sort of, to me, not quite, but it looked a little bit like if you were doing the Unmatched game with Disney characters.
Yep.
Yeah. And then we got in their game Venn, which is like Venn diagrams. You have pictures and you're trying to like make people guess what the Venn diagram is. It's a fun little party game.
Yeah, that sounds like a neat idea.
There was also a Harry Potter one, and then is it a Coco one?
There is a Harry Potter game, and then there's a Coco like Loteria game.
Yeah.
We also got a new expansion for Root, the Marauder. We should be getting a Root restock soon. We ordered it. It hasn't shipped. It's already sold out at manufacturer, but we should have enough to hopefully get us through a few months.
Maybe. I hope.
We ordered a lot. We'll see. We got a new game for guys who do Sagrada called Kites that is a real-time game where you're sort of color matching.
Yeah.
I played that at Gamma. It was a lot of fun. And we got a card game called Marvel Remix that I'm not 100% sure what it is.
But it uses the system of Fantasy Realms.
Yeah. And looked cool.
Yeah.
Which I never played Fantasy Realms, but it looked cool.
No.
All right. News. I left Star Wars and Marvel for our dessert.
Okay.
We'll just go through everything else. A bunch of trailers. Let's start with a trailer for Glass Onion, which is not a Disney property. It is, in fact, a Netflix property.
I was going to say, it's the other conglomerate.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, this is the Knives Out sequel. We've been looking forward to it, hoping it wouldn't suck. No, we knew it wouldn't suck. But we've been hoping it would like capture some of the magic of what was one of the best, you know, unexpected movies of the last few years. Rian Johnson's cool murder mystery. And it's looking good.
This looks good. I've seen at least a couple early reviews say that it's really good. Of course, they're doing the overhype thing of like, it's even better than Knives Out. And I'm like, let's
calm it down. I saw this yesterday, Nick, and I was like, whoa, guys.
I think if it has the same energy, I think it's going to be very enjoyable.
Yep. The cast is great. Dave Bautista looks like he's having a ton of fun being mostly naked.
Yep.
I thought that guy was saying that he was getting tired of having to like keep in super shape and do these mostly naked roles.
Well, apparently,
like
he still liked this one.
He's like, for you, Ryan, I will get naked.
it's
also, by the way, it's the kind of a teaser mood piece trailer, so it gives away very little, which is cool for a mystery. Other than the thing that was most notable for me was just that although we see them on a ship too, but there seems to be something on an island. Maybe most of the movie, I don't know.
It's in Greece.
And so that was giving me vibes of the Agatha Christie classic, and then there were none.
Ten Little Indians?
Ten Little Indians. Yep. It's got a bunch of different names. Several of them are not super cool. But yeah, it's a cool story though, and I sort of like that as a model. I have no idea if it's like actually the model or how the, you know, that sort of involves very specifically a mysterious thing where people start dying off, and you're like, oh, one of us must be the murderer. But what's the deal?
I mean, I think that is, but also Agatha Christie is definitely the watchword for the Benoit Blanc type.
Well, I mean, that comes from Rian Johnson's love of Agatha Christie. He loves those movies to no end, and he's sort of doing his run on them.
Right, but he definitely, like, his thing is, there's a lot of much more comedy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just the, like, incidental Poirot comedy. It's like there's a lot of humor. A plot serious enough to take seriously, though.
Yeah.
And his kind of, I feel like one of the best things about Knives Out was that his sort of progressive ideals were kind of front and center, and a lot of sort of lampooning of, I'm going to say, conservative figures.
The masturbating Nazi child was hiding.
Yes. I do know a lot of people, or a fair number of people, I think, on the right kind of went over their head.
That never happens.
And they were just like, it's just a fun murder mystery. Because they also did spoof, like, sort of new agey, kind of lefties like Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, that's true. Paltrow, but yes, she was playing
that type.
Yes. Yes.
Who played her?
Toni Collette.
Yeah, great job. But yes, in general, it was fun to watch that bad family of bad people be bad.
Yep.
anyway,
yeah. This is another great cast, like fantastic cast, and looks great.
This is the last trailer I'm going to watch. I know I want to see it. Zero chance I won't. But I don't want to know anything more that might hint at the mystery. I want it to go ahead and all be a surprise now.
I understand. I'm going to try and do the same, but we'll see.
If you go to movies, though.
Netflix. They may not.
It's debuting in theaters and then coming on Netflix.
I mean, that's the thing. This is that's the only thing that makes me nervous about it is a Netflix movie, and Netflix makes crap movies.
Not always. You liked Red Notice.
Yes. I do not want Glass Onion to be on the level of Red Notice. Let me be clear. I enjoyed Red Notice, but in no way was I like, oh, what a good movie that was.
I believe you might have to do a little digging, but you can find exceptions in there. Whether it's, there was something recently, Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
I didn't like
I mean, that's Ballad not super Buster recent. Either. Yeah, but everybody else did. That was just
not
you being
everybody else.
That was just you being a fuddy-duddy.
Netflix made movies worse. That's my worry.
There's, I don't
didn't
know.
They do
I don't
Martin watch Scorsese's thing?
Yeah, that wasn't great either. They have, this is my point, this is what makes me nervous. Netflix has a ton of good people working on movies for them, and nobody's done their best work for Netflix.
Well, here's the thing, though. That's subjective, because some people really loved those movies and find them to be great. You sure. just didn't care for them.
I
didn't care for a lot of them either, but...
I'm not... I watched Day Shift. I'll watch a sequel to Day Shift. I watched Day Shift. I watched Bright. Yep. I will watch a Netflix movie. But all I'm saying is, I need them to have at least one big hit. This has to be the thing that's like, oh, Netflix can make good movies.
Yeah.
And I want it to be this.
I have faith in Rian Johnson. Yeah.
Basically, it's kind of like Prime. Like, there are executives muddling with creatives. Like, that is going everywhere. So there's a stamp that goes on things. And so that's why Rings of Power has been so happy for me, is because, like, it is not... Like The Boys, like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, it seems to have escaped the stamp of the executives above it.
Right.
So it's not like I'm saying Glass Onion is going to be terrible because it's on Netflix. Just makes me nervous. That's the only thing. That's all I'm saying.
Gerald's Game, that was a good movie.
Gerald's Game was a good movie, you're right. But it wasn't Mike Flanagan's best movie.
I never saw Beasts of No Nation. Do people like that?
No, I never saw it.
It's supposed to be great. It's Idris Elba.
Yeah. I was looking at what the supposed to be the best ones.
Gerald's Game may be the best movie they've made. I think that's up there.
But they also did, I guess, what, like, I don't know, I guess you can't count, like, it's the miniseries and stuff, like Stranger Things and Mike Flanagan and stuff.
Their shows are fine. It's their movies that I think their movie division has an issue. But we'll see.
Interesting.
Anyway.
But I feel like we know that this is Rian Johnson's thing. Yep. I, like, is there, there's no particular reason to think that they would bring it down or there, can?
Who produces a movie matters. It does. Like, yeah. you will see interference from people who are like, they will make just enough changes that it could mess up something, especially something where the formula is so important.
Yeah. It would suck if this one was not at least pretty darn good.
Yeah.
I liked Don't Look Up. I liked that quite a bit.
Oh, you mean the Adam, what's his
name?
Adam McKay.
Randy hates all Adam McKay in every way,
so.
I know.
Randy, did you like Dolomite Is My Name?
I did like Dolomite Is My Name. That was pretty good.
Right. Yeah. You liked The Harder They Fall.
I did like The Harder They Fall. So they, you're right. They have made good movies. All right. All right. So that makes me less nervous. That's good. Because I've been disappointed more often than not with a lot of
Sea Beast was fantastic.
Sea Beast was fantastic. Okay, now animation's different.
But I suspect Ryan, it will, you know, whatever challenges it faces, it'll, I think Rian Johnson will make or break it. Yeah. And I think they're going to want him to do kind of, I think they probably were going to be mostly like, do that thing you did before.
Yeah.
And then it's on him.
And Daniel Craig has come out and said that he will do this as long as he makes him, so.
Yeah.
I like this, like, overall so much more, at least theoretically. Yeah. We'll see how the second one works out. So much more than him as Bond.
Yeah, I would actually like to be a lot more Benoit Blanc. I'd like him to be known for Benoit Blanc rather than Bond.
Yep.
I'm sure he's like, I'm tired of running around. I'm tired of all his physical exhaustion.
That'd be great.
I just want to walk around and kind of profess people are guilty. And
when his In Memoriam reel runs at the Oscars, it needs to be like, he was famous for playing Benoit Blanc. Did you know he was also James Bond for a short time?
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what I want.
I saw that, I read some behind-the-scenes thing where he was like, how he had to get back into character and, like, find that ridiculous sort of Foghorn Leghorn accent again. And it looks like he got it from the trailer.
Yeah, he does.
All right, what else we got?
We got the trailer for Quantum Leap, the remake at NBC.
Did you guys watch the original?
I've seen bits and pieces. I've seen a few episodes.
Not a single episode. And that's why I think I kind of liked this one, because I feel like the sort of emotional stakes of, like, kind of character-centric TV and stuff they've gotten better at it.
Yeah.
You know, as good as movies, sometimes better than movies. And so the idea of sort of... I like sort of what episodic television. I'm going to try it. I actually am not expecting to, like, particularly follow it.
Yeah.
But I was watching that trailer, and I was like, oh, I was more interested in this than I thought I was going to be, which was I had zero interest.
Well, it's kind of a good trailer. It drops you into sort of an event. There's
a bank robbery.
He's the getaway driver, and he has no clue how to drive or what he's doing there for.
Well, hilariously, because it's a period piece, he's from the present day.
Yeah.
And this is in, what, the 80s?
85.
And he gets in the car, and they're like, "Drive, get us out of here," and he looks down at his stick shift.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And then who's the guy who's his partner in the old show?
Oh, it was...
Dean Stockwell.
And what was the character's name?
I forget.
Ziggy.
Okay. And so his new Ziggy is this woman who
looks to be like his wife or romantic.
That's the wife of the real person, person he's the bank robber or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And she's like guiding him through how to use the stick shift as he's trying to get
away
from
the cops. But it's also something went wrong because she's like, you don't even remember who I am. Like he was not, his memory got zapped. The Quantum Leap project is a failed experiment.
That's exactly.
Not actually working on
it sort of makes sense nowadays that you would have some, you know, subplots working out aside from just whatever the episode of the week.
Yep. I thought the original Scott Bakula did a lot of work. He was very likable. This guy looks very likable.
That was the trick, I think, is casting someone else. It's where you weren't always thinking, huh, I wish there was Scott Bakula.
Right.
And they did a good job. He seems very charming.
Let me quick ask this for anybody who's ever seen any previous version. The way they were doing it is, as he played the bank robbers, they would do it like... you would occasionally see, like, scenes in a mirror or whatever, and you'd see what other people are seeing, and then you would
that
see...
That was definitely...
And then, I guess, did Bakula play the character most of the time?
Yes.
So it'd be Bakula acting like whatever he was doing.
Yeah, unless he looked in a mirror or some sort of reflective surface.
Yeah, okay. The audience did not see the other guy from the...
So whoever they... It's not going to be a whole lot of, like, some new actor of the week just story.
No.
Okay, got it.
It looks interesting. Again, as with Dave, I don't know that I'll follow this. Network TV is a hard sell on me these days.
It is.
But I'll check out the pilot at least. Looks like a good pilot.
Yeah.
We got the new trailer for Willow, which I think is the third trailer or second trailer.
I think it's honestly the first, isn't it?
We had a teaser trailer.
And then there was the behind the scenes one where it was them kind of around a table making fun of things.
Yeah, that was very funny, but like the weirdest sort of guerrilla marketing I've seen, because it was almost more like you know, like you see on a show of, like, extras.
Yeah.
Where they're, like, all kind of making fun of themselves. Anyway, this is the first one I saw that, like, had any sort of serious showed anything.
Yeah, I think this is the first time we saw any of, like, what the story was going to be. And it looks like you can't defeat evil because evil is back. And it looks like Sorsha, who... Was the love interest with Mad Mardigan.
Yep, and she herself was a bad person, but who turned good because of love.
has some connection to the evil and finds that Willow is the only thing that can stop them. So
probably her ginger hair.
Yep. So she sends a band of heroes to in search of Willow, and I think it looks pretty darn cool because I am like one of the 50 people who saw Willow as a kid and loved it.
I saw
Willow was like pretty popular.
Yeah, Willow's pretty popular.
It's a bit more cult, but like I probably hear about as much as I hear about what the other big fantasy ones of the 80s, like Legend or More Than Kroll, for sure. I mean, this was George Lucas produced and Ron Howard directed one of his early movies after Splash and stuff. Now, Willow's fairly well liked. It's just become a little forgotten because it's been decades.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I vaguely remember Willow. I've seen it a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
My roommate in college, he used to say that basically he's watched Willow in pieces a bunch of times because whenever he was scanning through TV, he would find Willow. Like, it was following.
But he only ever saw it Frankenstein form.
And so, but whenever he saw it, he'd stop and watch it.
Yeah.
But it was following him. He constantly kept finding Willow. And so I saw it a second time because he saw it. So I don't remember a lot
by
of
By the way,
it.
This is, by the way, how I know most Marvel movies because
yes,
of our
I understand
piecemeal those. Viewings at the store.
So Dave, you were saying this trailer was not as crazy because it didn't feel like Willow to you as much.
It didn't quite look like the, somewhat purely visual level. It looked like almost like a darker fantasy story.
Yeah.
The color palette and the settings and stuff looked a little more muted. And Willow did have some of those darker moments, but like, you know, there was also, I think, you know, when you see his village at the beginning and stuff like that, it's like, you know, it's kind of sunny day stuff. And there's
this is like a minute and 45 trailer. Can't see everything. Yeah.
But they jump around a little bit. Like
they
if
do.
You were to show a montage of the movie Willow, you'd see snowy peaks and you'd see like kind of dark crossroads and you'd see his bright village and at least some like sort of brighter stuff.
When we see the brownies, that's in the sunshine.
Kind of, yeah. So the biggest thing for me were seeing the actors. Like, seeing Warwick Davis was very cool.
Yeah, he looks great.
I like their new cast. I like the guy, whoever's playing their sort of roguish swordsman. I like him.
Yeah, I know the one of the female leads is the from Captain Winter Soldier, Soldier and Falcon.
And Solo.
And Solo.
Yeah, I like her. I like their so far what we've seen of their... I like their sort of fantasy, but this feels like the D&D show that I wanted Rings of Power to be.
Right. Rings of Power is good, but it's not D&D.
A little more fun. Yeah, I know.
They've also announced that at D23, they announced that Christian Slater is going to be some friend or something of Mad Mardigan. He is joining the cast as
really?
Well.
Yep.
I imagine they probably wanted Val Kilmer back, but the thing is Val Kilmer is just not up to it.
Christian Slater is such a that's Christian Slater person.
I think
casting seems weird to me.
Not to me. If they're trying to make someone that, because I think they're probably my guess is that he is going to be playing the cameo of what would have been Mad Mardigan.
Like that.
Maybe so.
They deliberately wanted someone larger than life to play that role.
I guess so.
He was in Robin Hood.
Maybe he'll play Will Scarlet. Anyway, I like
seeing the brownies and all that stuff. It does look like it's kind of got the bigness. Now, I will say, the original Willow was rather derivative. You know, it's like little Lord of the Rings here, some Star Wars mythology type stuff there.
Some really good, computer animation mixture stop.
Yeah, it had some early computer assisted stop motion.
Yeah, ILM stuff.
And it also very notably had a great score from James Horner, who did a ton of the best 80s scores like Aliens and Star Trek 2 and stuff like that.
Also, their bad guys look cool.
And they do again in this.
That's what I mean. In this trailer.
The original Willow had the, what's this guy in the skull mask?
Kale.
He was cool.
Yeah. General Kale. It's for sure what I'm going to try out, but maybe it's because we are in the midst of so much fantasy stuff. I'm not sure if it's gonna catch me. But that was always the case.
That's fair. I hate elves, but this looks good to me.
Yeah. There's no elves in Willow.
Nope.
No. Well, I don't actually hate elves. I hate all elf-centric fantasy fiction.
All right.
Turns out I'm not a big fantasy guy, despite having played D&D most of my life.
And also, of course, we were talking just the other day about how excited we are about Rings of Power right now, which is filled with elves.
Filled with elves.
So, Randy, you're loving our side conversation of all the talk about all the small stuff, huh?
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like, I hate elves the same way Dave hates assassins, which is to say that there's still some things that can get me. Except Dave hates assassins more than I hate elves.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
But I would show for the right assassin.
You do like the elf assassin from Dragon Prince.
I guess. It's not like a Hitman TV show.
If you mix up an assassin and an elf.
I'm trying to think. I think there was something like a few weeks ago that we were talking about where it was like an exception to my rule. Some movie or something that came out. I don't remember what it was.
I don't either, but there are exceptions.
There are exceptions. You'll be testing out Willow, and I will not watch John Wick movies.
There was a teaser for Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which, Nick, have you read these books?
No.
Okay.
I've watched the movies, and I thought the movies were okay.
Am I correct that little youthful children babies in these stories find out that they are from the lineage of Greek gods or something?
Yes.
And then later Egyptian gods.
Did your son actually go to one of the camps?
Yeah, my son, there's a Camp Half-Blood. My son does that every summer, so...
That sounds racist. I'm like,
it's not Camp Mudblood.
I'm just like, half blood is just it's just a strange terminology.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I get it. It sounds fun. I think I would be all over that as a kid because it's a way for kids to interact with mythology stuff, and all kids kind of like the adventure-y side of mythology.
But
having listened to a little bit of these audiobooks because I have friends whose kids are into it.
Yep.
It feels a little bit like Neil Gaiman for kids. Like he's definitely like trying to bring the big world of Greek gods into more approachable.
Wasn't the writer Rick Riordan?
Yeah, he's a great writer, and he's great. He's a good guy,
and
he's an Austin guy, I think.
Or was it?
He was an Austin guy.
So is the story focused on like Poseidon's kid?
Percy Jackson.
Okay.
Anyway, the movies I think have all generally I've heard rough stuff about them.
Yeah, they were okay.
And I think that they're probably
when they came out, they were clearly on the coattails of Harry Potter, and you got the kind of vibe. It's like, oh, they might have hurried this out so they could as quickly as possible get their kid franchise.
Yeah.
But instead, I think this is going to work better as a show because the story then everything doesn't have to be big and bombastic and fit in a 2-hour time frame. So you can do the camp and the kids getting to know each other and the other gods and sort of a bigger story. So I think this might work better. The teaser is just a teaser. I can't get a real sense of it.
Right.
But it's solid. It looks good.
Yeah.
National Treasure Edge of History. This is the new National Treasure show, which honestly, it almost feels like they slapped the National Treasure name on it. Like, this didn't feel a National Treasure to me.
No. That Riley and Harvey Keitel are there is kind of the only connective tissue. It just looks a little bland.
It looks like a puzzle. I mean, it looks like what's the Dan Brown books that you like, Dave? The that thing.
Robert Langdon stuff.
What do you call the what's the first one?
Da Vinci Code.
Stuff.
It looks like it's as much of that as.
By the way,
else.
I will always be very upfront about saying that those books stink.
Yes.
Yeah. They're
trash. The writing is really quite awful.
I don't mean to impugn you by saying
they have
like,
they have a certain addictive quality. But
fun
trash. And the movies are pretty watchable. What was I going to say? So I guess there's the old dude in it. Is that playing the guy that John Voight was in the movies?
No, Harvey Keitel is playing his character that was like the head of the FBI.
That was Harvey Keitel?
Yeah.
Huh.
The old dude is Harvey Keitel?
That was Harvey Keitel.
I didn't recognize him.
Absolutely
either.
Didn't recognize him. I thought it was just somebody doing a riff on John Voight's character.
Did too.
And that's why when I was trying to figure out, was like, oh, were they trying to say that there's, you know, the time has passed and that this is, she is the daughter of Ben Gates or whatever?
No.
Okay, so it is Harvey Keitel.
It's an entirely different family involved in
maybe
conspiracy stuff.
But it's like, it's presumably Harvey Keitel had the. Well, I don't know, like did he get willed, sent in a will or something, all of the secrets of Ben Gates?
Well, no, but he was, like, a member of, like, the Freemasons. I mean,
that's right. He was, like, part of the Secret Society
stuff. Yeah, so, I mean, definitely you could kind of shoehorn that in a little bit.
Sure,
it just didn't look as fun as I wanted it to be. National Treasure, at its core, is just a lot of, like...
Well, what I needed to see was actually a little bit of that puzzle-solving, even if it was just a line or two... Because, you know, it needs to be, like, kind of steeped in American history, I think. I think that's kind of a key part of it. I need to see them, you know, like, talking about something like the Declaration of Independence, Liberty Bell, you know, some famous Confederate graveyard. And it's just anything from, like, that's a big thing for American history, kind of.
And Catherine Zeta-Jones plays the villain. And she mentions something randomly, like, the Sisters of the Blue, whatever. And I'm like... I don't know what the hell that is. That sounds made up. It may not be made up, but it, like I said, it just, this did not hit for me.
Am I correct, by the way, that Sean Bean did survive that movie? There's one of those movies he survived.
Yeah, he's in prison somewhere.
Yeah, somebody's going to go to jail. If for people who don't know, I think we like the National Treasure movies.
Yes.
The first one is particularly fun. The second one is not quite what the first one is, but it's good. And I think we're all kind of hoping for this one to be good. But it looks like, you know, the kind of kids look like just, you know, Disney kids. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Disney teenagers that are like, you guys want to have an adventure, bro? I didn't get great vibes.
No.
Yeah.
This one I will not probably even try out unless I hear it's good.
Yeah.
Which I won't.
Way to go, Dave Prophet.
Savage.
I have a sense.
We saw the trailer for Disenchanted, which I've seen Enchanted, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, I mean...
Same thing. You know that, Amy Adams?
Yep. Amy Adams.
She's a princess who kind of finds her way through magical stuff in our modern real world. And
she marries a real world guy named Patrick Dempsey.
Yes. But their courtship was the whole movie, right? It was like her adjusting to it and... Yep. And among other things, like an iconic scene when she sings, there's a couple really good songs in it.
Yep.
The big showstopper in the park, mm-hmm. a very fun song. And also the bit where she works with what she has in New York as far as the classic princess and her singing animals.
Yeah.
So she is like, these like rats and cockroaches and stuff like that are like helping clean up her house.
Yeah.
And by the way, that sounds gross. Like, that could easily have misfired, but it's delightful.
Yeah.
It's a very fun movie.
And then James Marsden's is, like, the guy that she was supposed to marry and comes to our world to sort of rescue her and ends up...
Is this in the original, or are you talking about...
Yeah, that was in the original. Yeah.
I thought it was Marsden, but I couldn't remember for sure.
Yeah. And it looks like everyone's reprising their role.
Going to recur in this. They've allowed the characters to age a little bit, which is nice. And that
the thing is the villain. It's Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, Maya
Rudolph.
Do
love Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, she's good in everything.
And, and what would you, if you were to sum up the plot of the?
It looks like she's kind of there. She's had a kid. She's moving to like the suburbs in a lot of ways, and things are not going the way she wants them to. So she starts wishing them into existence. And I think she's slowly corrupting herself.
Does she have some magic wishing power?
Yeah, she gets like some sort of wand.
About that. Okay.
Like that's in the original
movie? Is that the original or is that new?
No, that looks like new in this one.
Okay.
And it's probably given by Maya Rudolph, who looks to be playing like the evil queen.
I'd be like, every time she uses it, she falls more into my sway.
Yeah, essentially. And it looks like a fun concept, and this just looks fun. I love Amy Adams.
Based on the quality of the original, it was a very fun surprise. I remember when I saw it. I feel like this could be decent. I'm not gonna assume it is, but it's got solid chance.
Yeah, we got the Little Mermaid teaser, which is the new Hailey Bailey as Hailey Bailey. Is that right?
I think
Halle Bailey.
Halle Bailey.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to say because it's close to Halle Berry, but it's not Halle Berry.
In fact, there's a whole bunch of people who are tweeting at Halle Berry that she's too old to play the part, and she's like, "Yeah, I agree with you. Jeez. I am not playing this part."
People are dumb.
This is a true teaser trailer. It's got a lot of lush visuals as the camera just pans through the water.
Yeah.
You hear the sort of echo of the big ballad from Little Mermaid, Part of Your World.
It's actually reminiscent of the original animated trailer, because they did something very similar.
That's true. Yeah, they. That's exactly right.
And you glimpse, like, Flounder, and...
Yep. You see her tail swing, and it looks really cool. Like, it's got that kind of...
I almost wonder if it's not, like, shot for shot, but very close, because I remember this.
I think it is. I think you might be right.
I think if that's what it's a riff on.
Because I think they did that with another one, too, didn't they? Did they do that with Beauty and the Beast
they
or something?
Have. Here's the thing, we're talking about this off mic a little bit, and the thing is, like, as a philosophy, I kind of don't want them doing live action of perfectly good animated series. Like there's no reason. Beauty and the Beast is fine as is, Aladdin is fine as is, there's no reason to make live action. Oh. Yet, on balance, I've liked more of them than I've disliked.
Yeah, although, from what I've heard, Pinocchio is pretty bad.
I've heard rough stuff about Pinocchio. Lion King, I thought, was a huge disappointment.
Oh, Lion King was abysmal.
In some ways, the more CG heavy they are, the worse they are. And yet, I will say, Jungle Book was one of their best ones.
Yeah,
I thought,
Jungle
and
Book
that
was
like
fun.
All CG practically, like the whole jungles and all that stuff. I think everything but the kid.
I have friends on my Facebook feed who are very much like purists of like, why are you doing this thing? And they hate all of them. And I'm like, I get that. This one at least has the virtue of pissing off all the right people, and if only for that, I'm happy they're making it.
Yeah.
Yes, for those people who by chance have escaped the controversy, first of all, good job. Stay away from it. But they had the gall to cast a black actress yes. as Ariel, when everybody knows that the original Ariel in the story was probably not described at all.
Right, yes.
I'm sure she was like a young girl of 16.
Yes, people are very upset because it turns out they think all mermaids are white. And I say to those people, mermaids aren't real.
Yes.
All mermaids are manatees.
Anyway, she looks great. She's got essentially what Ariel needs, which is she's young, she's pretty, and she has a sort of wistfulness, which is, I think, the key characteristic of Ariel.
Yep.
By the way, I love Little Mermaid. I know that it's kind of broadly thought as a little bit retrograde as far as, like, yes, like, she's chasing after a boy. She does her binding spell without knowing anything about what's happening. She changes who she is. If you think about it too much, it absolutely falls apart. Yep. If you watch it kind of based on fairy tale logic and of course, just to enjoy the Disney presentation of songs and humor and all
and
of that
great
stuff.
Great animation, too.
Really great animation. It launched the Disney revolution. Like, they might not be where they are right now,
but
for Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
It is just a very fun movie. I mean, Sebastian, I think, is, like, sort of, for me, best sidekick character there is. It has some of their absolute best music. I don't know that I'm particularly enthused for this because the live action stuff is hit and miss. But like I quite like Jungle Book. I quite liked Aladdin.
Yeah.
And several of the other ones, even if I wasn't big on them, I was like pretty solid.
You know, I'll say this though, not that I was a huge fan of Maleficent, but I think if they're gonna do something. A live-action, like, Ursula story about her, I think that would be interesting. That would be something I'd like to see.
Yep. There's maybe been almost a little too much of what I would call the wicked, you know, the villain was actually a good person sort of thing. And
exactly.
It's like, let the villain have fun being villainous.
Yeah.
But I kind of agree with you.
Ursula's bad. There's really no.
I think that they're even
absolutely
going
a take.
To.
There's a take that, you know, the Triton's, like, thing, his staff, Trident, is Ursula's. That he and Ursula were basically a couple.
That's true.
And he basically took her kingdom from her, and that's why she's bitter. He's like she's
a little
like
bit
ex.
Like Odin kind of stuff from the Thor movies.
Yeah.
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 Although I'm like I don't want to see Triton thrown under the bus. He's generally supposed to be a dad who's out of touch, but a good guy. And
he's
I don't
got
want him
some
to
anger
quite.
Issues, though.
That's true. He's like you dare.
See, that's what I'm saying, Dave. Here's what. Triton's abusive husband. I'm just going to say.
Oh, my God.
Well, now they've cast, Melissa McCarthy as Ursula, so.
Yeah, there's a... Triton is, the actual... The prequel to Little Mermaid, people are not going to know this, is actually caught in a hot tin roof. and Stanley is a Triton.
Oh, itch.
Yeah.
I am not a big Melissa McCarthy fan, so we'll see how that goes
for
me. The one thing I wanted to say just about the philosophy of all this, one of the podcasts, I've told you all this before, one of the podcasts I listen to, the Tolkien professor stuff where he talks about Lord of the Rings and other medieval literature and things, he talks about how, I think he was actually sort of standing up in some way for fan fiction because he said basically all medieval literature is fan fiction.
Yeah.
You know, everything that was ever added to the King Arthur mythos was all added by somebody. Who was just like, oh, what if the French were like, let's add Lancelot in there, and then just everybody, and then, like, sometimes it stays, sometimes it goes. But his broader point was that we retell our favorite stories, always and constantly, you know. We go back to these legends and myths over and over again because Robin Hood has something endearing for us, because King Arthur has something endearing.
Yep.
And it is going to change and be, you know, have different values depending on when it was told. And that was the case 1,000 years ago, too. And so I don't think it's like some, yes, Hollywood is absolutely could stand to do less of it.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think it's like just this damning thing. And I was like, oh, my God, if only this money could have gone towards my favorite cause, you know.
I agree. Anyway. All right. Let's talk Star Wars.
All right.
So, a little bit of casting news. They cast Iman Esfandi, who apparently was in Robert Rodriguez's Red 11, which I've never heard of.
Okay. And, maybe that's upcoming?
He had a small role in King Richard, which I've never seen.
That's good.
He is playing Ezra Bridger in the Ahsoka series.
Yay!
So do people like Ezra? He's from Rebels, right?
He was the lead of Rebels.
I think people love Ezra. Yeah.
Cool. I don't know. I don't.
And he ended his story ended in a kind of precarious. We don't know what happened to him. Kind of.
They're clearly. It is clear that Filoni, who is basically in charge of Star Wars at this point, is like, I want to wrap up everything with Rebels. So they've live cast half that cast. Like they've also got Sabine. I think we'll probably see Hera. Like. They really have
live action Chopper. Give me him.
It's fascinating to see the marriage, which has been a pretty good one between live action and animation, which that had never been done with Star Wars before. And in general, Star Wars, the movies haven't liaised well with any other properties.
Yeah.
Just touching on bits and pieces from the books, touching on maybe a few bits and pieces from the comics. I'm talking like stuff in the 90s and things. But for the most part, they weren't particularly friends. Video games and all that. Yep. Now there's a pretty healthy relationship between all of them. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Cal Kestis from the Jedi Fallen Order games show up at some point in live action. And they seem to be doing a good job translating the cartoon people over to, Mandalorian and other stuff.
But when will Jax the Cartoon Rabbit show up?
Probably in the background somewhere.
Somewhere. Yeah. He'll show up.
Cad Bane will kill him.
I'm excited for this, because...
which one are we talking about?
This is Ahsoka, the Ahsoka series.
Okay. Yeah.
Which they... I don't know if they showed too much from that. I think they maybe showed a little bit.
Is there a formal trailer out yet?
No, not yet.
Okay.
No, we're early on. I think this is until 2023, 2024.
Okay.
But definitely looks like we're getting all of Rebels. I know Thrawn is involved, so...
It's too much stuff. Stop making so much stuff, people.
Dave, I want to tell you that's not going to happen.
No. If there are, say, going to be like, let's say, 6 or 8 Star Wars shows in a given year... what I say is just take off, get rid of 2 or 3 of them.
No.
That's all. That's all I need.
The Mandalorian Season 3 teaser, which is coming in 2023.
Yep.
It's mostly a mood trailer. It looks like a lot of Mandalorian fighting.
That was a good trailer. And it looks like they go to...
Mandalore.
Looks like the factions between, like...
Well, they outright show the throne room on Mandalore with, like, the throne and Bo-Katan.
Yep. Is Bo-Katan part of the Death Watch?
No, she's not. She's part of just the Mandalorians.
You know,
is Mandalorian part of the... Is Mando part of the Death Watch, or is that a different cult?
Well, okay, so Bo-Katan was...
Deep breath.
She was part of Death Watch. I'm remembering
now. That's what I was thinking.
She left and to join her sister, which is Sabine.
Yes.
As part of the... I forget, but she's looking for the Darksaber to reunite all of her people. And, of course, Mandalorian has the Darksaber right now.
So, I will say this. I don't particularly like Mando being involved in big, epic Mandalorian politics. I don't want him to be... have Throne of Succession stuff, stories. I like when he was on the run with a baby.
Yeah,
it's too big for me. It doesn't mean that they're not going to do it well. It just means that I have a little less interest in that. That said... They showed scenes with him and Grogu that were fun.
Yep.
There was like very, very cool action featuring him and other Mandalorians. And I'm trying to think some favorite characters. Who's the mechanic lady who helped him out on Tatooine?
Looks like a new droid gets introduced, a new R5 unit, which shows. They show him in the Naboo starfighter. So
I didn't quite catch that.
So it looks like Mandalorian is slowly coming around to his hatred of droids.
I'm kind of with you, Dave. I really like this trailer. Because I liked all the Mandalorian stuff in Rebels and Clone Wars, mostly Clone Wars. I think it's all Clone Wars.
Yeah.
I like all that stuff, so I don't mind them expanding on it in live action. But I did like Season 1 and 2 are very much about Mando as kind of like a man out in the, on the fringes working on his own.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily want it to become all about the Mandalorians all the time, but I bet it won't be.
No.
Yeah. I have pretty good faith in their abilities at this point to find a balance that I'm going to like. But I'm like, I'm already tired of the throne stuff in Game of Thrones' new show, House of the Dragon.
I mean, I feel like he's going to Mandalore because he wants to become a Mandalorian again. And he's got to go underneath into the caverns of underneath Mandalore to sort of wash away his sins. That's what
he's gotta go fight the Mandalorian.
That's what the armorer told him to do to become a Mandalorian again. So, and I feel
what
like
what did she say to do?
There's like some like caverns underneath Mandalore where he has
like
to
the
sort
proving
of wash
grounds
it.
Or something like
yeah,
that.
Something along think of yeah along those lines, and he sort of have to become a Mandalorian.
You
again.
Have to go and wrestle a super Mandalorian.
And I feel like he's going to get caught up in like the civil war that's going on Mandalore at the
I
moment.
Mean,
yeah.
You thumb wrestle him.
I will. It will be kind of cool to see that because we've seen Mandalore on like Clone Wars and stuff like yeah. that. It'll be interesting yeah. to see it
live
realized
action
in live
cool.
action.
Like all the brightly colored armors looked really awesome.
Yeah, it did. It looked pretty cool.
And then the drop ship, them falling out the bottom
I also,
of the ship
honestly,
cool.
I like Bo-Katan calling him Grogu's dad. They're like, you think yeah. your dad? I'm like, ah, yeah, he's your dad.
Yep, that's
he's space dad.
Starbuck as a Mandalorian.
So, now, does that mean that he escaped Luke's cult like?
Yeah, he chose
teachings?
To. Remember in the Book of Boba Fett?
No, yeah. I don't really remember it.
Yeah, he said no to Luke.
I think I was kind of annoyed at that whole subplot, but if it resulted in him leaving, then that's good.
Yeah, he was like, no, Luke, I don't like your...
If they're not going to make the Jedi look more appealing, if they're going to make them kind of seem cult-like and say, sorry, you can't have this gift from your dad, you have to choose that, or a life as a celibate monk, then Grogu should give him the finger.
And Grogu's like, no, like Captain America, I fuck.
Oh no, I don't like this conversation at all.
Look, Grogu may look like a baby, he's like 80 years old. You can't tell me Grogu hasn't gotten down with some frogs.
No,
he's Frog Lady's baby daddy, that's what it is.
I'm gonna move on the conversation to just anything.
Alright, let's talk about the Tales of the Jedi trailer.
Looks awesome.
Yeah. This is an animated series. Nick, you said there's three episodes each of... It's six episodes.
So six episodes.
But maybe
they
jump around
shorts.
In time a bit?
Yeah, and three of them are about Ahsoka and various points of reference. It looks like yeah. her being chosen to become a Jedi,
yep.
what that entails. It looks like Anakin training her.
Yep,
and,
being a big old jerk.
And it looks like maybe after she left the Order and runs across one of the Jedi hunters.
Yeah.
Inquisitors.
It looks like.
And then we're going to see Dooku's corruption.
Yeah, which is, I think, one of the most interesting parts.
Right, since I guess he was the Jedi Master of Qui-Gon?
Yep.
That's the deal.
And a buddy's
that sort of sounded interesting. This to me looked a little samey. Like, I haven't watched as much of the animated stuff, like, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure I've seen Anakin training Ahsoka before.
No, you haven't.
I'm pretty sure I like maybe even in the first episode. Of
I mean, I know this is Filoni, I'm sure, and he can't help but do an Ahsoka thing. Since
I mean, Ahsoka's
character.
A good character, and I'm happy to like I'm down with her getting some more screen time. But
I think the Dooku stuff is most interesting.
Yeah, that seems like potentially more interesting. He's kind of sort of alternated between seeming like a fairly intelligent villain and sometimes kind of a generic sort of. Bad guy. You know, like Sidious Light.
But I don't think we've ever seen... I mean, I think it's been, like, written on of, like, why he turned to the Sith, but I don't think we've ever actually seen it.
He's actually gambling debts.
Yeah. And he was the leader of the Separatist Party, so he kind
actually,
of...
Actually, he flipped a coin.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Well, I turned to the dark side and became an evil Sith.
It's the most you ever lost on a space coin toss.
And we also see a Yaddle, which is interesting in the trailer.
You're going to have to explain what that is.
Yaddle is
Lady Yoda.
Lady Yoda.
Oh. Okay.
So we actually get to see another one of his kind.
Is that the one on the council?
Yeah, the one with the hair.
Okay. So we're expecting she's going to have a role?
Yep.
Is that the deal?
She shows up in the trailer fighting Dooku.
Yaddle. It's fun to say.
All right. Yep. Oh, I thought that was Yoda. I thought they were showing him.
No, it's Yaddle.
Okay.
That was back when he had a thick head of hair. That was his young bohemian days when he was in college.
All right. Let's talk about the Marvel news. There's a bunch.
I was going to say, there's a
whole bunch. Well, a couple of villain reveals. Tim Blake Nelson, who was, last we saw, was getting gamma radiation poured on his head.
Wasn't that like 20 years ago?
It was in the Hulk in 2009.
Okay, so...
2008, yes.
Who was he?
Tim Blake Nelson, you know, he's from...
I mean, not the actor, but rather... I know he, like, played Rorschach
Samuel
and all
Stearns.
That stuff. And
yeah.
What's that?
He played Samuel Stearns.
He was Samuel Stearns in the original Hulk movie. He's helping... Not the original, but the The Incredible Hulk.
The Edward Norton one.
He was helping him out, trying to cure the radiation thing.
Okay, that's... He was the guy.
And there was an accident, and he wound up getting bubbly head from...
Yeah,
from
some that. Of the goo dripped on him.
Got it, yeah, yeah.
And so they were setting him up to be the leader, and I'm like, there's no way to see that again. And when I did my big rewatch, that was my big takeaway. I was like, oh, I kind of would have liked... Like, their casting was good. Like, I would have loved to have seen Ty Burrell's Doc Samson. I would have liked to have seen Tim Blake Nelson play... the leader, and it turns out I'm going to get to see that because he is the villain in Captain America 4.
Only 13 years later.
Yes. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm kind of excited about that.
I think I'm also excited that I don't think I've ever seen Leader take on like Captain America.
I don't think, yeah.
It's a fun team, or fun face-off.
And then we got the villain in the Ironheart series is going to be the Hood.
Yep. Parker Robbins.
Yep. Played by Anthony Ramos.
Yep.
Created as in the comics by Brian Vaughn of like Saga fame and Why the Last Man. But a character who got, unfortunately, kind of early on in his run, a lot turned around by Bendis.
Yeah.
Who kind of re-envisioned him from being a small-time Hood with a sort of weird demonic cloak he ended up stealing and using.
Yep.
And turning him to like a master criminal, and do we figure he's going to be a master criminal?
Yeah,
in this?
I feel like.
So are we going to get the Bendis ruined version?
Well, they've described this as tech versus magic.
Yeah.
So Ironheart versus Parker Robinson.
If the Hood is the main bad guy, then it's not going to be the dumb kid who with the Russian mobster wife or girlfriend runs small time thieving jobs and stuff.
Yeah.
I half wonder.
I guess you've won, Bendis.
Ooh.
I half wonder if.
Or they'll find something good to do with it.
They'll probably find something good.
Yeah. Nah. I'm not excited about the Hood, but there are ways to make.
He's an interesting anti-hero. You know, his whole original deal was he was like Peter Parker if Peter Parker wasn't on the straight and narrow. It's like he was like, with great power comes great opportunity. But he also had a rougher life, and basically he was a guy who had like a streak of sort of heart of gold, but was. Pretty skeevy, and couldn't come around the way Peter Parker did.
I just had a thought that kind of connected a few things in the MCU. Like, if the boss that the Wrecking Crew and She-Hulk is talking about is Parker Robbins, considering he is usually runs kind of C&Z list villains in his gang, gathering kind of, that's why he had all the
and he has magic associations.
Asgardian stuff.
Yeah, it would sort of work.
Yeah. It would sort of work.
Kind of would. Ki Hu Kwan, a.k.a. Short Round.
Yes.
Yay. Is going to be in Loki Season 2 as a TVA agent, which is cool.
Yep. His breakout in
Everything Everywhere All at Once,
Definitely has catapulted him to bigger things.
But he was also...
is that a Short Round joke?
He was... there's that great picture going around because Harrison Ford was also at D23 to promote
Indiana Jones.
So there's a picture of the two of them reunited, which is cool.
Yes. He's like... hugging Harrison Ford, and looks like he's like the happiest guy in the world.
Yep.
Just delightful, pure distilled joy.
They announced the director for Fantastic Four, and it is Matt Shackman, who did WandaVision.
Yep.
I gotta say, I'm okay with this. WandaVision's my least favorite of the Marvel TV shows, and also I'm still
really least favorite.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
What else
okay.
would be? What else would be?
Falcon and Winter Soldier.
No, that's one of my favorites.
Yep. Because
that's
you made a mistake.
That's in my that's all my favorite characters in that Grimwald stuff. I have a huge fondness.
I just didn't have any of the ambition that the others do.
I fully admit it's not the best show, but for me, it's one of my favorites.
It's not a bad show. It's a good show.
No, it's lower tier.
Yeah.
Lower tier, but not lower tier than WandaVision. Super self-indulgent in his first three episodes, and I'll never forgive it. actually, I don't care that much. I just mostly think it's funny. But anyway, I'm sure he'll do a good job. I'm still a little bummed that it's not the director who did Spider-Man, because he did such a great job with what I think the trick to this... Yeah.
Well, he's going on to the Star Wars
Yeah, I don't care about Star Wars as much as I care about Marvel. I think the thing with Fantastic Four, the thing that worries me is, this is a tricky thing. There's already been... four Fantastic Four movies, if you count the Martin Roger Corman one. They've all been terrible.
That doesn't get counted.
I mean, it's probably at least as good as the last one that Josh Trank did.
Oh, God, that
so,
was bad.
I'm very... there's a lot of work to be done to dig out from underneath that the weight of the franchise that Fox put on it. Someone just like X-Men.
I do not envy that writing group.
It's a lot of work, and so I wanted to be the guy who had proved he could do it with Spider-Man.
What led you to just bring up FF?
Because Shackman is directing
it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And he's taking over John Watts, who's going to do it.
I think he's got a unique voice, but he also knows how to work with Marvel. Yeah. So I think that's a good, ultimately,
should be good. They announced the Thunderbolts movie lineup.
Yep.
So now I'm a little bit disappointed because I wanted Thunderbolts to be something else that it's not going to be.
So, and I think, I don't know if people know, but Thunderbolts in the comic were we talked about it a little bit before, the disguised Masters of Evil.
But I was with various versions. This, there's actually been four or five different versions of the Thunderbolts.
Correct. To the point where it's kind of very muddy now.
Yeah.
And I guess for better or worse, they can kind of do with it what they want.
Yeah.
It's just that it's not going to usually be the Avengers. Yeah. There's going to be something kind of a little more sinister or dark about them.
Them being a skeevy government team fits. That's a thing they've done in the comics now a couple times.
Yeah. It was well done because it was Warren Ellis, but it was a Suicide Squad knockoff.
Don't you think this is the team that is trying to fill the void for the Avengers, since the Avengers are dead?
I think that's probably what it is, and that's what they're doing. They're sort of doing the Dark Avengers take, because it's Val's putting a team together. Yep.
What's the deal? The Avengers dead?
Well,
most of the Avengers died in Endgame.
The big ones dead. Thor's gone off Thor's world. Thor's gone.
Iron Man and Cap are both dead.
Vision's dead.
Vision's dead.
Scarlet Witch is wherever.
Yeah.
Cap's not dead.
But he's retired.
Hawkeye's retired.
This does have sort of like a U.S. Agent as their Cap.
No, I mean it's yeah. I guess that, but Red Guardian also. But it's a Winter Soldier.
Yeah, Winter Soldier is their Cap. They have a bunch of Caps.
They
don't have any Thors.
Do they have any Hulks?
They don't have any Hulks.
Yelena seems to be leading.
Black Widow.
Yeah, there's definitely a more kind of urban ops type team.
This is like an espionage team. They've got Val is sort of the person who puts it together, but it's got U.S. Agent, Yelena, Red Guardian, Winter Soldier, and Taskmaster.
I think there are still people we don't know about.
You think?
I think Zemo is involved.
That's a big lineup, so.
Yeah, I have this feeling that I know people were disappointed that Zemo wasn't publicly discussed. I suspect that he will have a role.
Either he will be the foil, or he will be a Citizen V, and that will be kind of a reveal or something.
That'd be cool.
I would love for them to introduce a couple of new people. I would love to see Screaming Mimi as Songbird.
Yeah.
And somehow get that in there.
It'd be cool. I don't see it happening, but I would like that.
Yeah, because they need to diversify the power thing.
I bet not all of these people might survive. They might have a little bit of a Suicide Squad body count. Not that bad, actually. But I wouldn't be surprised if Songbird or somebody came in as a replacement for that, and they can get a little bit more of the classic.
I will say, I'm happy I'm getting more David Harbour Red Guardian, because he was a joy in Black Widow.
Well, people were saying this is kind of Black Widow, too.
A little bit.
Taskmaster, Red Guardian, Yelena, that's all Black Widow stuff. Sure.
Yeah.
And then U.S. Agent comes from U.S. Agent and Winter Soldier, so it's a little bit of that Cap energy, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the same vein as Secret Invasion for me, and it's going to be in sort of the Black Ops side of the Marvel Universe.
And this is a full-on movie, right?
Yeah, it's a full-on movie.
Yeah, they're not doing this as a show, so they're definitely going to put some weight behind it.
I sort of wish it was more like them doing Avengers-y type things and being, you know, Masters of Evil. I think they would need to do a spin on it. Like, it's you can't do just what you did in the comic, but I think I would rather that than the Black Ops team, as you know, not as big on the Black Ops military stuff.
I know. Which brings us to Secret Invasion. Secret Invasion is a story of Skrulls trying to take over the Marvel Universe, and big reveals that the characters you've loved all this time have been Skrulls this whole time.
It's about the original comic?
Yes, the comic.
Yeah, and it was like...
I hate Secret Invasion. It has a really terrible ending.
Well, it has a good concept.
It's got a great concept. The notion of a Skrull Secret Invasion...
Bendis was always good with concepts.
It was like, essentially, like, when you say Secret Invasion, it's essentially like an infiltration.
Yeah.
It's Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah. Did they get to, like, was there any particular thing where they're like, oh, they've infiltrated S.H.I.E.L.D., the president or whatever, or probably somebody
who was... I don't remember, because it was all nonsense.
It was.
I mean, it was... Bendis was bad at the writing portion of it. So, concept-wise, it was fine.
So this trailer, basically what they're doing is they're taking the idea of it and just completely redoing it as an espionage thriller in the Marvel Universe, which last time we did an espionage thriller in the Marvel Universe, it was Winter Soldier, which is arguably their best movie.
So, am I correct? What do you call it? Samuel Jackson comes back from spacey stuff?
Yes, he comes back from space.
And I presume we're going to learn more about what he was doing in space?
He may have some information about...
Well, he's been hanging with the Skrulls.
It looks like he does. And early on, he's talking to Rhodey, And he says something like, he's like, what do you know about your security team?
Yeah.
And he's like, what do you mean? What do I know yeah. about him? Like, and I kind of liked how that scene happened. Like, Rhodey is like, do you mean like, do I know about their personal lives or yeah. what's yeah. what's even this question? But we know he's talking about Skrull stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a vibe to it that feels almost like, well, like Winter Soldier, 70s thriller
yeah.
sort of vibes.
Yeah.
It is weirdly. I think because I thought it was going to be a movie, I expected to see more powers, costumes, any of that sort of stuff.
No, that's a TV
and
show.
This is mostly guys in looking like they're dressed up in plain clothes, kind of doing spy stuff.
Well, this looks like it's like spies across the world.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a cool concept. We get Martin Freeman's. Yeah.
Everett Ross.
Everett Ross. It looks like Olivia Colman is playing somebody in the British government.
Yep. Or possibly a Skrull.
I don't think she is. I think she's. I think I know who she is.
But see, Nick, that's the trick. You wouldn't know because he's
right.
Be Skrulls.
I was going to say those things aren't mutually exclusive. You could be playing somebody in the British government. You could be playing a Skrull.
Right.
Yeah.
But having Olivia Colman in the Marvel universe is pretty awesome. She's amazing.
Olivia Colman is the Skrull queen of England.
Is Olivia Colman the chick from Doctor Who
and Broadchurch?
Broadchurch, but she's also done a ton of
been a ton of stuff.
Like she's won Oscars, like two in a row.
That's right. Another thing about of course, I know her from Broadchurch, and she was great.
Yeah, we also saw Martin Freeman. We also see Kobe Smulders.
Yep.
But also Amelia Clark is playing someone. We don't know who she's playing. And there's someone else that I saw like an actress who I didn't know. I don't know. Is it Gugu Mbatha-Raw? Is she in this? There's
it can't because she's in Loki.
Okay, so it's not her. That's right. There was somebody I saw that was like
in shadow that we couldn't really tell.
Another spot.
Could it have been Nakia? That would have been that would make a ton of sense.
No, I think it's somebody new.
Okay,
but anyway, this looks exactly. I did not know what Secret Invasion was going to be. I didn't know what they were going to do with it, but this is very interesting to me. I'm all in on.
Well, and I know that they announced Armor Wars as well, which is supposed to take up the reins right after Secret Invasion.
Yeah.
So the fallout. So, which leads me to believe that Rhodey's going to play a pretty big, important role in Secret Invasion.
Yeah.
Which I love Don Cheadle, and I like. I guess I saw an article saying that he's no longer under contract from Marvel, so he's basically just like, if I want to do something, I'll do it.
He's like, you better impress me, Marvel. I'll say this. Although I'm not as big on the spy espionage side of the Marvel Universe, I also like, I've seen it be great with Winter Soldier. And I like, in general, the MCU ability to surprise me.
Yeah.
And so it's actually not necessarily a bad thing that Secret Invasion, it could be a very good thing, doesn't look like I expected it to. I didn't want it to be Bendis either. I just thought it was going to be more superhero-y.
Yeah.
But this could be pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And the last thing was we get the trailer for Werewolf by Night, which is done in sort of a grindhouse style, but in black and white.
Yeah, it's very a weird, cool. Seems like a fusion of horror ideas, but at its heart, what you see in the kind of staccato trailer is what? A gathering of hunters?
It looks like Ulysses' blood is maybe his corpse, I'm not sure.
It does seem to be his corpse.
Reanimated corpse has brought...
It's a puppet, yeah.
Has brought a group of supernatural hunters...
Not Ulysses' claw, Ulysses' bloodstone.
Bloodstone.
Right. A lot of Ulysses in the Marvel Universe.
Monster hunter.
Has brought a group of monster hunters to somewhere, and I guess
presumably to hunt the werewolf.
Hunt the werewolf by night, played by
Gael Garcia Bernal.
Bernal, yeah.
Gael. Also, Laura Donnelly is cast as Elsa Bloodstone, so I guess they're introducing her.
Yep.
And then I think the woman playing Verusa, who is like the seems like she's the like the mistress of ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
I know her from stuff. Like, she's one of these that girls. I've seen her a million things.
Well, we also glimpsed Man Thing.
Do we?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. This is a one-shot movie?
So, yeah, this is what they call a special presentation, which there's... I guess I've heard Marvel is going to start doing these for random things, because they're doing this one. They're also doing the holiday special, the Guardians of the Galaxy one.
Okay.
So, this, I guess, is a new thing that Marvel's trying out. Yeah. Which so, I'm all about.
One-offs, but that aren't feature movies.
Right.
Yeah, so we don't know how long...
It's going to be their little proving grounds. It's Marvel fanfare, if it were the comics. And do we have any notion as to how tied into the MCU this will be? Like, in other words, do we assume that this stuff is canon?
I assume it's canon,
yeah.
But I don't know.
Okay. But, I mean, I would imagine since we're getting a lot more supernatural stuff, like with Blade, I bet this might play into some of that.
But also, it's Werewolf by Night. Where's Moon Knight? I want Moon Knight to show up.
Where's Dracula?
Where's Dracula?
And where's my money... Dracula.
Yeah, this trailer impressed me because it's a different tone of everything they've done.
Yeah, it kind of looked fun.
It is weird to me to do the black and white of Universal Monsters, the Grindhouse look, and what was the other thing you said, Nick?
Hammer.
Yeah, like Hammer horror films.
Because they can't go full on like crazy horror because
they're not going to be like super super gory. But you know, Sam Raimi at least opened the door for them to kind of do some more messed up stuff,
like more chillerish kind of thing.
Yeah. I dug this, and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah, and it's soon. It's October, it's, like, 7th.
Yeah, it's October 7th. I think we're, like, 3 weeks out or 2 weeks out.
Yeah, that's crazy.
About 5 minutes, I think.
It's right now. All right.
We've watched it. We'll be reviewing it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about comics for the week. We were talking about comics for the week of Wednesday, September 14th.
Yep.
And
pretty sizable week.
It's a pretty sizable week. Let's start with a big one this week, which is Batman versus Robin. Finally, they're going to fight.
You know, I think based on what I know of the three of us, in general, wanting to see infighting among Batman's sort of family is probably the lowest thing on our list.
Yeah.
And yet, this actually ended up being pretty good.
I had no interest in this, and even though... I mean, it's written by Mark Waid, who I really like. I was like, I don't know that I really want to see this, but...
Mark Waid, who in the last few years had a really good run over on Daredevil over at Marvel, among mm-hmm. other things, and has been doing pretty good stuff at DC with the Superman Batman World's Finest comics out right now, which this has some links to, although you certainly don't need to have read it.
So this is Mark Waid, Mahmoud Osran on art, and the art's gorgeous, by the way. It's very good. Really nice.
There is one panel that a splash page of Batman in there that I'm like, oh my, on the aftermarket when this sells on eBay or whatever, he's gonna get like $10,000.
He's come a long way from Dynamo 5.
Yeah, that's what it was. I knew he did something early on.
Yeah.
One of the twists is 4 pages in. I feel like we can actually reveal it.
Okay, but before we get to it, do we want to just say kind of what the premise is here? Is it's a mystery, but Damian is like, it's almost like he set a trap for Batman when Batman returns to home to Wayne Manor, which he doesn't, like, I guess, own anymore? Is that
or he
right?
Doesn't live there anymore.
Doesn't live there anymore. His fortune's been kind of wrecked.
He lives in a brownstone in the heart of Gotham.
Okay, right. But he gets in there and he goes into like the Batcave and stuff, and like Damian's there and there's some other people there. I'm not going to say who they are, but it's like he set a trap for him. He's at odds with him, and Batman's like, "WTF, Damian?" But it's actually pretty cool, and they both come off as smart and dangerous, and nobody gets kind of like punked. It's actually a really good balance. But there is also something else notable that happens, Randy.
Yes, yeah, so those of you who read Tom King's Batman run might know, or maybe you don't, that Alfred was murdered. He was, Bane, like, snapped his neck.
Yep.
And although there have been a few decent stories since then, especially some Tom Taylor follow-ups, it kind of happened weirdly, unceremoniously, was barely noticed, except among Tom King followers, and not quite given the weight it should have, considering it seemed at least final-ish.
But that was, like, what? 3 years ago?
Something like that. Yeah. It's been a bit.
But, about 4 pages into this, it looks like Alfred's back.
Yes.
And Bruce Wayne is... There's a great...
That is also a mystery.
There's a great moment, because he runs through there, there's little captions that are his thoughts, and he's like, Clayface, Dr. Hurt, Cornelius Stark, Karma, Hugo Strange, Court of Owls. He's basically, like, running through in his head who it could be.
Anybody who could be either impersonating him or have created a good impersonation.
But Wade quickly sells it that, no, this is Alfred. Or at least a very convincing facsimile, and that's one of the mysteries. The other mystery is, why is Damian doing this? And that we get to at the very end. But Damian seems to have racked up like some magical abilities that he's using here.
Right, and some magical allies that were interesting.
So what's going on? I don't know. Damian has been... It looks like they're riffing on some of the stuff that was going on in Damian's Robin series, which I really like.
Yeah, they straight... one thing I like about Mark Waid, which is, I know he's an old school guy, but he seems to be playing ball with like the new kids, which I think is good when you're playing in the sandbox. You want to try and do the best you can with what you got.
Yep.
And so he straight references stuff, and we've liked the new Robin run.
Yep.
But he mentions the Lazarus tournament. He talks about stuff that was happening in Tom King's run, and that's how he knows, or that's what one of the things that makes it seem so like it is Alfred, which is that the thing he's talking about is like the last thing that Alfred would have remembered from that exact scene where Bane killed him. And so he kind of uses it to test him. Anyway, this is one of those ones, like, if some other writer was doing it, I think it could fall apart for me. But because I feel like the characters are being smart and there's some cool action in it, and I was like, oh, Damian, he's a little dangerous when he's like this. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, but Batman, man, he's freaking Batman. He's not going to get knocked over instantly. But the kid who knows all of his secrets is a big, big danger to him.
Yeah.
And who was also trained by League of Assassins. And when he's like, when he
turns, and Batman, for that matter.
And Batman. And when he like, when Damian like wants to hurt you, like, he knows all the ways that he can with Batman.
Yeah. I remember when you both didn't really care for Damian.
That's true.
It's true, but we came around.
Yeah, he's a good character.
I think I was always at least open to the idea of... Actually, that may not be true, but that Grant Morrison could kind of pull him out of being, like, just a little shit. Yeah, it's kind of taken, like, 10 or 15 years, but eventually I'm like, Damien's all right.
Yeah.
I didn't want... You know, I usually don't want those things that kind of push the superheroes forward into a place where you have to rethink them or allow them to age a little bit. So marriage, kids, stuff like that.
Well, Damian is now like 16 and has been for 10 years, so...
I don't know, he still feels like he's 12 sometimes.
At any rate, he is now, ironically, frozen in time, just like the characters he may not be frozen in time.
Eventually he'll be 25 and Batman will still somehow be like 30.
Yes, that's how it works.
But...
You know, Batman is like... You know what I like about Robins?
Oh, no. No, don't say that.
I get older, they stay the same age.
That's what
it's the reverse. He's like, I stay the same age, they get older.
Is this a miniseries, Randy?
I believe it is a miniseries. Yeah. Like, I hope it's an ongoing. Like, this is the new status quo. Batman and Robin fight every issue.
Just every issue. You know, if you ever read the first few years of the Avengers, it kind of feels like that.
That's true.
It feels like it could be called Avengers versus Avengers.
It's Methuselah versus Hawkeye.
Nick, I believe you were not as big on it as us, but you liked it.
I still think it's a good comic. Okay. I have some reservations.
What's your reservations?
I mean, I want the Alfred thing to be real.
I don't
want it to play with emotions. And, like, at the end of this, he goes away again. Because that would be sad.
I don't think that it is going to be a cheap thing, but it does strike me, you kind of mentioned this, I think, off mic earlier, Randy, that they could do something where it's like, you know, his ghost has been summoned because of those magic users, or, you know, we don't know what all is going on.
In order to save the world, Alfred has to sacrifice himself, which would be a better death than Bane snapped your neck and nobody cares.
Right.
Well, people cared.
Or they could find one of those compromises, like, you remember way back in the day in Starman in the 90s? He would meet with his brother once a year.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I want that literal thing, but, like, there's things you can find like that where it's like, Alfred's lost to us, but, you know,
when I dust, his ghost arrives and tells me I'm doing it right.
I was going to say, like, you know, he knows supernatural people like Deadman and stuff like that. It's like, he may be able to periodically talk to him, to his surrogate dad.
Like I said, I have reservations, but it's Mark Waid, and I have faith in his ability and his knowledge of the DC Universe to come up with an idea that is satisfactory.
I think they went they go so far in this first issue to try it to show that he's doing that Batman has thought this through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he seems like it's really, he thinks it's really him by the end.
That's a lot of work if
it's just
It'd
be weird if they were just to undo it and say, oh, it was Hugo Strange.
Turns out it was Clayface all along.
I actually guessed it right on the first try. It's just I forgot to poke it and see if it was Clay.
Like Clayface? Uh-oh.
It's like a Scooby-Doo moment. Yes. Pull off the mask.
Right. But it's Clayface that he shape changes into Hugo Strange, and who turns into a hallucination from the Scarecrow.
We've got Bone Orchard Mythos, 10,000 Black Feathers, number one. This is a...
Slow down for just a second there, because the title is weird.
I know.
The 10,000 Feathers is like the main title.
10,000 Black Feathers.
10,000 Black Feathers. Bone Orchard is like the blanket line of, this is Jeff Lemire's new horror series.
I was going to explain that.
You were doing it the wrong way.
All right.
Jeff Lemire was like, he looked at what Stephen King has done and was like, I can do that too.
Yes, I think he did. I think the point where he kind of, I think, acknowledges it in this one because the characters talk about the Dark Tower series.
Yep.
So this is Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. Like, this is their shared universe thing they agreed on.
Yep.
A horror shared universe at Image. The first one was a full-on original graphic novel.
Right.
And was called The Lighthouse or something else?
Something like that.
But isn't that like a series of OGNs?
I think there may be... There's going to be some more... Basically, this is going to be both OGNs and comic series, which will ultimately get collected as graphic novels. But yes, some will be serialized first. What's funny is that that's the same artist on both of them. So, like, I guess they could have done this as an OGN. But, weirdly, I feel like in one issue this had more density of storytelling than in the Lighthouse thing.
I agree.
Which I really thought I would like, but ended up disappointing me. But this is off to a good start.
Yeah, this is, it's got two stories. One's a modern day of a girl, like, coming back to her hometown and talking to the mom of her best friend. And the other is showing her and her best friend becoming friends. But clearly something happened, like her friend either went missing or died, and they both bonded over, like, Stephen King horror and fantasy.
Yeah, they talk about Ursula Le Guin.
And now she's a writer, the one who survived.
But her, like, her writing career is kind of stumbling.
Yeah, but she may be seeing, she finds a black feather, and it seems like she's talking to something in the shadows.
Yep. This has a Stephen King vibe to it. Yep.
Little mixture of Lovecraft.
I would say it reminded me of It in the sense of, like, seeing the characters as adults and as kids, how they met.
Yep.
But it, like, didn't feel particularly derivative of It. But it has... There's a fun thing of, like, the kids bonding over their kind of nerdy stuff.
I also appreciated that Sorrentino was able to sort of flex his artistic abilities a little bit and do two different styles. Like, one kind of, like, more... gothic looking in a way, and the other, a little more...
Where they're adults, it kind of is like a more shadowy sort of gothic noir sort of look.
And as kids, it's a little brighter.
Yes. Yeah. There's literally less... There's less shadow is drawn on the characters. They're just more kind of like solid colors and stuff.
Honestly, it was my favorite thing I read this week.
I think so, too. The two books we've just mentioned are.
Yeah, those are the two, yeah.
But I think I actually did like this one better. What's it called? One Black...
10,000 Black Feathers.
10,000 Black Feathers. Doesn't exactly roll off
Does
the tongue.
Does not roll
but
off the tongue.
I'm not against it.
Or if you want it, the full title. Bone Orchard, 10,000 Black
Bone
Feathers.
Bone Orchard
the
presents.
The Bone Orchard Mythos, 10,000 Black Feathers. Number one.
Something is killing the children.
Something is killing the children.
In the bone orchard.
The nice house on the lake.
Something is killing the children. Nice house, lake. Both have less words in it than this title.
It's true.
Lemire is like, you know what, Tinian? You think you own weird titles in horror? Guess what?
But the thing is, Tinians are easier to say.
It's true.
So as an kind of a weird tangent, we did get a hardcover that is a bunch of... scary horror story
anthology.
Oh, Razor Blades?
Razor Blades.
Did we ever talk about Razor Blades?
We did not. That's why I bring it, because it's got Tinian stories in it.
But it's also like, it's a horror magazine that he did. It's like, collects all his articles.
Yeah, but we have it. It looks awesome. Yep. I really want to dig into it.
Yep. Speaking of horror, I guess it is October. That makes sense. Well, it's not September.
It's September. Practically the same.
But Midnight Suns, Marvel's new video game that is going to be sort of their magic thing.
It's like XCOM, but with magic.
Is that
characters.
What this is tying into?
Yeah, it ties into that.
It's the team includes, you know, popular characters like Wolverine, but also like magic from X-Men,
Blade, Ghost Rider,
Wolverine.
A few people I didn't know as well.
Girl from Runaways, what's her name?
Nico. Wolverine.
There's some of the character I don't know from The Strange Academy.
Oh right.
But I think in the game it's going to be some characters get like magic armor, and it's going to be a bunch of like.
I'd forgotten that video game was coming.
Yeah,
what's weird, and I don't know if the game is like coming soon or coming in like 6 months.
I don't know.
But like, there is not a thing on this. Normally, they would go ahead and say like, you know, prequel to the video game, or you know, tie it into Marvel's upcoming hit game.
Right.
But like, they actually don't make any mention of it, so you could be forgiven for not remembering it because they don't mention it. But this is, I believe, the team in the game.
Yeah.
And I know that there's neat sounding stuff in the game where it's like you can set up and develop their headquarters just like you did bases at XCOM.
Yeah.
But there's more like, who do you train with? Do you go to Doctor Strange to learn the mystic arts?
Because it's also like a turn-based thing, right?
The action is turn-based, although weirdly it's not quite like XCOM. I believe you deliver commands to your characters via cards. In that sense, it's actually weirdly sounds like if people who play like Memoir 44 or games like that, where you have a sort of a limited hand size, and you it's like, oh well, I don't have like my big attack in this one, so magic is going to have to do this or that this turn, and like that actually sounded interesting to me just because I know that I was sort of resistant to that idea, but it ends up doing a neat. It makes you think in neat ways. It's fun to like Memoir 44 and games like that are very fun.
Then we've got Kevin Smith has a new book over at Dark Horse called Masquerade.
Emphasis on mask, like a hero mask.
M-A-S-K-E-R-A-D-E.
Yeah.
It's in this weird, like, it seems like it's supposed to be modern day, but it feels like a cyberpunk city. It's like this Trenchin, maybe a city.
It's
city
like San Francisco gone wrong.
Yeah, it's like this, it's called the Trench now. It's like a beat-up city. And
1990s Trencher is back.
It's a story about it. There's a TV producer who gets in some hot water. His career gets torched, and he now has to work with this reality influencer style. And yet, also, there's someone out there murdering people. I can't tell you what this is about. It's a very strange opener.
I was under the impression that there's vigilante stuff.
There is a individual that is running around, sort of like not just killing people, but like out for revenge. So it's got
you buried the lead.
So it's a little bit revenge. I thought it was an interesting first issue. We will see what Kevin Smith can do with it, but
Kevin Smith comics are, except for his Green Arrow run, by and large, skippable by me.
Yeah.
That Black Cat Spider-Man that took, I don't know, 7 years to finish.
Yeah. But he's like, don't worry, everybody. In that time, I added a sexual assault to her backstory. So,
Unfortunately.
Image has a new book called The Least We Can Do, which seems to be sort of a high magic fantasy kind of thing. It's very pretty art.
Yeah.
If you like Lovecraft, there is a comic adaptation of Unknown Kadath, which I guess is one of his stories.
The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, or Kadath, I don't know. I've never known how you say it.
It looks like a pretty straightforward adaptation of that book with some nice art. Star Trek Lower Decks gets a series. It's original stories. Ryan North of Squirrel Girl and Dinosaur Comics fame writes. It's very snarky. It feels very much like Lower Decks.
However, it does feel like Lower Decks. I will say that the story itself was kind of fun.
Yeah.
You told me about the premise. What's the basic hook, Nick?
Basically, they're utilizing the holodeck in sort of the way Boimler wants to sort of experience what Picard did and do kind of his, like, noir detective thing. However, I forget her name.
Mariner.
Mariner decides that that's boring and wants to do something more fun, so she decides to create, like, a Dracula.
Right.
And
is it like literally based on like Dracula from the novels
stuff? Yeah.
But then there's like in the typical Trek style, there's some sort of weird energy surge from the planet atmospherics or whatever.
I always thought that was cool. In Next Gen, they did the whole Moriarty thing where he actually became like a sentient person. Yeah.
And very true to Trek's progressive ideas, they weren't like, we got to find a way to stop this. They're like, oh, we're going to find a way for you to leave the holodeck and be a sentient person and go off and live a life.
Yep.
And they did.
Spoilers.
But, quick flashback, 1990 spoilers.
I will say I am not current with Lower Decks. I kind of periodically check in every once in a while.
Yep.
But this was a fun little excursion.
Cool. It felt close enough to it.
It did.
That's about it for, like, new stuff. There's also, there's a bunch of graphic novels that came out this week that I don't think I necessarily made note of. There's an issue of Superman Son of Kal-El, which is really good. There's a Daredevil issue, the finale of Spider-Punk, second issue of Predator, third issue of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which introduces a Black Cat Spider-Man.
Yeah, that was a cool one. What do they call her? Night Spider or something
Spider.
Like that?
Also,
yeah.
That's Dan Slott writing.
Okay.
Also, Spider-Man India returns and a new character called Sakura Spider. So
nice.
I think that's everything comics. So let's take ourselves a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some horror movies and a board game that I played. All right, before we get to the horror section of this podcast, which I believe is most of what we're talking about this week, because it is September, and that's what we're going to be watching. If we'd had time, I think we would all like to catch up on Rings of Power and She-Hulk. We all love Madison, of course, and
this third episode
fun stuff.
Was
cool. Yeah, there's some really cool stuff. We got to see Numenor and Rings of Power, and like a really dope kind of almost escape by the
super
elf.
Cool stuff.
I can't say his name. A with something with an.
But alas, we need to talk about movies, and also last week Nick talked about John Carpenter with Dave and me for about 20 minutes, and then the computer ate all of it.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to replicate that.
Yeah, we'll probably do a slightly briefer version, but we'll hit the key stuff.
Yeah. But before we get to that, I played a board game this week.
Mm-hmm.
I played a new game from AEG called Wormholes.
Okay.
Which is basically, it's got a hex map, and it changes every time, and there are 10 planets on there. And you have a spaceship with 3 energy, which means you can move 3 spaces every turn.
Okay.
And you have a set of 5 wormholes, each of which has it's basically numbered 1 through 5, and they're little wooden discs, and when you place your one on one side of the board and your other one on the other side of the board,
you go between them.
They flip over, become active, and you can teleport between them.
Oh. Right. Cool.
And so what you're trying to do is you have these cards that represent the 10 planets, and each turn you can draw up one time you can reload passengers. Up to 4 cards in your hand. So you have 4 passengers at any time. And then you are dropping these cards off at their planet, and for every card you drop off, you get 2 points.
So you're a space taxi?
You're a space taxi.
I wouldn't have called it... it's Wormholes, I would have called it space taxi.
And at the end of the game, you get 3 bonus points for every planet beyond 5. So if you get to all 10 planets, you get 15 bonus points.
Okay.
And then, so that's most of it. But also, when you're dropping these wormholes... other people can also use your wormholes, but they have to pay you a victory point when they do it. So if you set up a good network, you start getting victory points from other people using your thing. But that, I mean, because there's a timer, you also get points for discovering the planet. So after the 10th planet has been discovered, there's 3 more turns and the game ends.
Okay.
So the timer is like somebody is discovering planets?
There's a stack of tokens, and the tokens represent points you get for exploring the planets. And after you get to the bottom one, there's a little one that's like says basically start the timer.
The end game begins.
And then it's a 3-2-1 countdown. It counts down the round.
You mean like 3-2-1 like moves? There's not like a literal timer.
The tokens say 3, 2, and 1.
Okay.
So on the person's turn who got discovered the last planet, on their turn the next time they pull it up, they pull off the 3, there's 2 left. They pull off the 2, there's 1 left.
So you have 3 more turns.
But there's not a literal countdown timer, which would make me nervous.
There's not a little countdown timer. Woo! There's no real-time mechanics, none of that.
Oh, thank
there's
God.
A giant holographic thing that's
but yeah, like
3.
Yeah, no, this is more like, you know, like in Pandemic, when you know you're coming up on stuff, certain things, you know. And there's lots of other games where, yeah, you kind of know when the end game
that
is happening.
That sounds fun, though.
But it's really
fun. That does sound fun.
I mean, I basically explained the whole game. There's a few little tweaks and things, but I basically just explained the whole game to you guys in a couple minutes. And the game itself takes maybe 45 minutes with the people who know to play it. So quick play. Lots of different... There's 2 different sides to the map. There's...
Is it backstabby?
A little bit, because, you know, if you place a... Not really, but if you place a wormhole...
I know what you're saying, like kind of in that Ticket to Ride way. Yeah. You might steal somebody's thunder.
Yeah. But you also... Yeah. You can't,
that's a balance I usually like,
all
right?
You can't block off a planet. So, like, you can put... If you use somebody's wormhole to go to a planet, to you know, you pay them, and you have set your other wormhole, you can then drop your new wormhole there, and then you've got to transport back.
Mm.
It's just that you have not discovered a planet. You didn't get the points from discovering the planet.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different things you can do to game. When we played the game, I played with one of my friends who wins every game we play, and he was about 10 points ahead of us, and the rest of us within 2 points of each other. And for this friend, usually he's like double our point total. So the points are very much like it's a within a few points kind of game. There's not a sense that one person is running away with it. I really enjoyed this. I think it's very playable. And there's a lot of repeat to it. So I definitely would definitely point people to it. Especially Ticket to Ride's a good comparison. I hadn't thought about it, but it makes sense. It's got a little bit of that Ticket to Ride transport aspect to it.
I will just call it Wormholes, aka Space Taxi.
Space Taxi. Other than that, I've been watching, TV, movies, and I watched this movie's The Orphan, which, so there's The Orphan First Kill, which is a new movie that came out on Paramount Plus.
Right.
And is a prequel to The Orphan, which came out in 2009.
Right.
That's a big gap.
It's a big gap, although the young girl who is, like, playing the lead must have a condition or something, because she doesn't look to have aged 13 years.
Or they did
time.
Really good.
I don't know. At any rate, I'm going to spoil a little bit about it because the thing is, orphan.
I guess what you might want to say that, like, if it sounds intriguing, this is kind of has some neat twists in it. And so skip it. Skip what Randy's saying if you think you might want to catch it.
Although I will say, I don't think I love this. Nick, you've seen
I saw both.
You've seen both. So, and Dave, we've told you the spoilers, so I wasn't sure if you're going to watch or not. But I don't know that I love this. I'm like, oh, you should all go out and watch The Orphan. But it was interesting to learn the
twist.
Would
you say kind of a good one-time ride-through?
Not even that. Honestly, really? I was bored for half of these movies.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. I was under the impression just from the glee with which you described their bonkers twists.
No, I am delighted by the twists, but I'm not sure it's worth the journey.
I got it. I got that.
And I don't know if, Nick, you agree with that or not.
I think the first one is pretty rocky. I think there are moments that are good.
The first kill is definitely better than
first the kill. I think just the approach is better.
Here's the thing. I think you can watch First Kill without watching Orphan, and I think that's what I would do.
Yeah.
So I'm going to spoil The Orphan a little bit. Because The Orphan is about this girl, Esther. Is she Esther in the first
yes.
one? So she was adopted from an orphanage in Estonia, and then the family that adopted her, their house burned down, and she was the only survivor, and she is adopted by this new family that lost their child.
Yes.
And to a miscarriage. They have two kids, one of whom is deaf, and they're like 5 and 8, maybe, or 5 and 10.
Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark.
Vera Farmiga plays the mom.
Yep.
The dad is one of the Skarsgårds.
Is that Peter Skarsgård?
Lesser known Skarsgård. There's many of them. There's many Skarsgårds.
Dwight Skarsgård.
Dwight Skarsgård. Liam Skarsgård.
Otis Skarsgård.
Otis Skarsgård. they adopt this kid, and things are weird sort of right away. And then it starts to look like she's married a little bit of a murderous kid. Like, there's something wrong with her. I was like, is it supernatural? She's got these ribbons on her wrist and her neck. And I was like, is she one of these, like, crazy Japanese spirits where, like, if you pull the ribbons off, her head floats off or something?
Or is she saying, like, did you ever watch the Macaulay Culkin, The Good Son?
No.
It has
I was
kind
wondering
of,
if that was supernatural or just, like, an evil kid.
Evil kid.
Like, yeah. Psychologically.
So this is more, this is an evil kid. So she's an evil kid, and she starts manipulating the other kids, and she's like, basically, it seems like she's and the mom is starting to get suspicious, and the big twist at the end. I'm not going to give the full twist away, but the twist of what's going on is bonkers.
It is.
Yeah, you told me, and it was pretty fun.
And so that was what got me. Was the twist? Was like, oh, I can't believe that. That's crazy. They did that. But the movie itself, I'm not sure was worth the journey. So,
Orphan. It sounds like you feel somewhat about it the way you did about what was the James Wan movie.
Oh, Malignant?
Malignant,
yes,
yeah.
It's in that same ballpark. You're either going to love or hate this.
Yeah.
That's better.
Well, you know, like...
is it better than Malignant?
No, Malignant is like 10 times better than
Orphan. Yeah, I would agree with
that.
I would agree with that. I didn't like Malignant either.
but also...
But I like Malignant for its bonkersness.
Right, right. Anyway, proceed, sorry.
Anyway, Orphan First Kill.
Yeah.
If you're gonna watch The Orphan, you have to watch it first because the twist is spoiled in Orphan First Kill. Like, we know the deal in the very beginning of The Orphan First Kill.
Right. Even though it's a prequel, don't watch it first.
Right. But that said, I think it works better because then they can't rely. One of the things I had trouble with The Orphan is they spent so long setting it up. I'm like, just tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
And The Orphan First Kill doesn't do that. Like, we already know what's going on, and so it's a little different tension.
Yeah.
But as I was watching it, Nick and I, we had the same experience. We're watching this, and we're like, almost an hour into this hour and a half kind of short horror movie, we were like, are they just doing basically a remake of The Orphan here? It's like, feels like the same
yeah.
conflict, the same tensions. But no, they are not, because there's another bonkers twist, and it was even more bonkers.
Yeah, I will say that the big name in this is
Julia
Stiles,
yeah.
who I really like. She just pops up randomly
yep.
in places.
Yep.
She used to pop up in every Shakespeare thing
yep.
that you could
yep.
ever make.
Yep.
And then she's kind of gone on to do some random stuff.
Yep.
So, but she's always good.
Yeah.
And she really brings it with
She's great here.
As a mom who...
Who's starting to suspect that this person they've adopted might not be what they thought.
Yeah.
And it's really good.
But it is a little bonkers.
The twist is great. Again, I don't know that I super recommend it, but if you are going to watch them, I would watch First Kill. I wouldn't watch The Orphan.
First Kill is like the polished... the pacing is a little better.
Yeah.
The twists and turns
are you saying
little...
that you could start with that one?
I would just watch First
you
Blood
could.
And watch The Orphan.
It's not like necessary.
Is it because it contains the plot twist of the other one?
I think so.
There, I mean,
yeah.
there's that plot twist that they do reference.
And then there's
a
wild swerve.
A more bonkers one.
You told me and I was like, I have this feeling like I am usually not necessarily one for these kind of movies, but I did like Malignant. It's probably the kind of thing I might watch every 7 or 8 years,
yeah.
or every 10 years,
yeah.
or something like that. But I had a good time with it. And when you told me the twist, I was like, that sounds like a lot of fun. I actually will probably be able to watch it, even knowing that twist, and probably enjoy it, yeah. I think.
All right. You guys want to talk about 10, or X.
Yes. This ain't no Grant Morrison story,
so,
Randy.
So A24 has decided to make a trilogy out of this, because today they just announced that Max Triple X Ian is coming.
And what did you just say?
It's M-A... Triple X Ian, because the main character is Maxine.
That's Maxine spelled with triple X's. Yes. I see, yes.
She was the main character in this one.
X.
And she will be in the sequel, but there's also a prequel that comes out this week that focuses on...
What a weird thing to become a franchise, because to quickly say the premise here, this is a horror movie from Ty West, who made the movies The Innkeepers and
House of the Devil.
House of the Devil, neither of which I really liked, but both of which had some stuff I liked in them.
I liked Innkeepers quite a bit.
Have you seen House of the Devil?
I don't know if I have or not. I need to watch it.
Okay. But he's a filmmaker who's got some popularity. He kind of films stuff in a very slow, deliberate style for the most part. Mm-hmm. That's a little reminiscent of... Like sort of 70s horror movies, and this one specifically evokes sort of the kind of grindhouse style and washed out look of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
But I think he opens up a little bit in this one with sort of pacing that is definitely more... There are moments that feel kind of drawn out and kind of elongated.
But you have about four or... We have like six characters who are all talking.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more social.
A little more social, a little more fast-paced. I mean, it opens up essentially with a murder scene at a house, and then it kind of cuts back to 24 hours earlier, so you know shit's going to hit the fan. Yep.
And there's a lot of meta stuff in this, including the characters talking about movies that jump around in time.
Yeah.
Because they're making a porn.
Yeah, it's a bunch of 20-somethings and I guess a 30-year-old, 30-something, making a porno.
In the year 1979,
when
there was still, when that was just starting to hit and like the home video market was kind of like on the horizon, which is where really, for those who don't know the history of pornography, that's when porn took off. Was the home video market, because as they sort of mention in this, it's like it's when you didn't have to be the perv going to the pervy theater. You could watch it in the safety and comfort of your own home. Nobody needed to know about your sick perversions. but yes, the X of the title is like X-rated movie. Yep. But it is also mentioned early on, the girlfriend of the guy who's the producer, director, producer?
Producer.
He's called producer, yeah. He's kind of maybe just kind of bullshitting, but he's like, you got that special something, baby. He's like, you got the X factor.
Yeah.
Something, you're going to be a star.
But because he doesn't want to pay, like, the big money for, like, to film in the city and get all the permits.
He's clearly a little bit of a bullshit artist.
Yeah, he kind of finds an out-of-the-way remote
It's like a, like, house. Practically, like, yeah, like a farmhouse kind of thing with, an old dude who's, like, willing to rent, like, the extra guest house that's out nearby. And they're like, oh, that's fine, we can go film there. He, of course, doesn't tell the old guy what they're doing, what they're planning to do there. Let's see, also along for the ride is the photographer, a kind of a nerdy dude with long hair.
Yeah.
And his girlfriend, who's like, wears a crucifix and seemed like she's a little bit of the good girl type.
Yeah.
And is like, oh, I didn't know we were going to be doing this, or I don't know if I'm ready to do this. She does know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then finally, there is the stars of it. Pretty blonde lady.
Brittany Snow.
And the black guy who looks a little like Shaft, who is the star of it.
Well, I believe he is a rapper, if I'm not mistaken.
Really? You know, I'll say this, right?
Kid Cudi?
Yeah, that's a name. Just to quick jump ahead, so I didn't really like this movie. I am no surprise, I didn't like his other movies. This is kind of the last chance he had for me, and it didn't take.
Right.
But, Nick, you did...
I liked it well enough. I don't think I loved it, but I think there were...
You're going to watch the others, though, probably, right?
Well, I'll probably have to watch them by myself, because Kaylee hated this movie.
She was more in the same spot as I am, although if I had to guess, we probably disliked different things about it.
There was one sequence in particular that I thought was super well shot, and it's the scene where Maxine takes a dip in the pond. With the
Let's not say exactly what
it's just
is.
Really, really well done.
I agree. That scene was very visually fascinating and simple in a lot of ways, and yet the way it
was, the tension, I was like,
he's pretty good at creating a kind of different tension from horror movies. That although there are some jump scares, he broadly doesn't do too many of the traditional horror things where, like, the music builds up and, like, tells you when it's about to happen. So there's a certain kind of, like, fine line tension he does, like, you know, on a wire that I think he's pretty good at.
He's at the bottom tier of the, Ari Aster. Who's the guy who does the Witch? A24
people. Oh, shit. He's got a weird name.
Robert Eggers?
Robert Eggers. Yeah. So he is the bottom of the tier.
For me, I wouldn't even consider him close to those people, but he's made by A24, which means he gets to get considered. But yes, you're right.
Made by A24? Are you saying it's a mafia thing?
No, I'm saying he was like a Frankenstein creation, a human golem.
I was just going to say A24 brought to you by Godfather Pizza.
I wanted to just quick loop back, though, and say a few things I did like is Kid Cudi. Did a good job as that character.
Yeah.
Like, not only did he feel like somebody from the 70s, and then broadly that aesthetic is well handled, and I was never anything less than convinced I was looking at the era. It even looked a little bit like the sort of naturalistic lighting you would get from just, like, home video of the era. Not I'm going to say cheap. It didn't look like it's literally home video. I just mean he does a kind of thing where he captures the aesthetic of that. Which is to say, sometimes slightly, you know, shots could be washed out by the sun, or harder shadows, or colors, or just kind of have that look of film stuff from the era. But anyway, Kid Cudi does a good job of playing a guy who is both kind of, he's kind of chill and happy to be doing this life of porn.
Yeah.
He's also like an ex-Vietnam vet, though, and there's one or two scenes that, where that, you know, that kind of focus on that, and I'm like, he was actually quite believable.
Yeah. Honestly, I kind of appreciated some of the character backstory that we get in, like, little snippets. Like, even the photography, like, the director, essentially.
Yeah.
We get a little bit more with him and sort of how he views kind of pornography and...
You're talking about the cameraman guy?
Yeah, and why he, like, when his girlfriend wants to be in it, like, how he reacts to that and sort of the fallout of that.
Those are kind of interesting scenes. I don't want to say too much about it other than it has a sort of slasher vibe to it and sort of reveals about exactly what's going on. But I felt like none of the reveals were exactly exciting to me, that the big the end stuff wasn't real big. And I don't really do slasher movies. That's just not my thing.
You didn't grow up watching Jason?
I actually did, but I think I was, like, grudgingly watching it. it's, like, not something I would ever return to. That said, I know that there's a contingent of horror people that really like those. And if you are one of those people, you should go out, you should watch this movie.
Halloween is my... That's kind of my thing for...
Halloween is an exception.
Yeah.
It's a big exception to the rule.
Because
it practically invented the genre, but it also, like, was already the best one of its time.
Yeah, but I say that, and then I'm like, well, Scream is technically a slasher.
It's a response to it, though.
Yeah.
These are all ones that are kind of exceptions.
Yeah.
There's some twists and turns. I do agree with you. The guy is, like, interestingly portrayed... even the skeevy producer guy is not, he's like... He's not a monster.
No one here is, like... Well, I mean, there are some people that are kind of, like,
Yes. but like, of the leads, they are all sort of flawed but halfway decent people.
Yeah. Takes place in West... Or was it West Texas?
Something like that. Everybody's got a bit of a Texas accent of some stripe. I can't say much more without getting into the reveals, I think. But a few things about the reveals didn't sit well with me, and I thought were kind of slightly exploitation trashy.
Yep.
Which I suspect was probably intentional on his part, but just not my thing.
Yeah.
All right, shall we... Do we want to talk about John Carpenter?
Right. Yeah.
Yep. I'm going to watch the recording a little more carefully this time. Because, last time there was a very good discussion. So Nick, just to catch people up, you had not seen In the Mouth of Madness...
I had not seen In the Mouth of Madness, and I had not seen They Live or Prince of Darkness in I don't know how many years.
You'd see one time.
So which, in some ways, it was almost like a first time for all of these.
Yeah, essentially because
For you, that's like, I mean, for Dave, that's how Dave watches movies. But for you,
it's a rarity.
That is there. If you've seen a movie only once, it's like you've never seen it.
Ironically, by the way, since these are John Carpenter movies, I've probably seen all of them at least 4 or 5 times.
Yes. Well, and the cool thing about this, I will also say, is that when I originally viewed some of these, I was definitely younger and probably to the point where I couldn't grasp a lot of the concepts.
I get that.
And then now
there's a few particularly weird ones in
this. And now that I'm watching it with different eyes, essentially, I'm like, oh, wow. This is some crazy shit.
They live, you know, there's like the multi-level capitalist critique amidst the alien invasion sort of thing.
That is just as good today
There's the nods to Rowdy's wrestling roots and some of the toughness.
I don't know, we'll dive a little deeper in on these, but Prince of Darkness, there's this weird physics that was like playing on the then cutting edge physics. This was kind of the 80s was an era when a lot of pop physics guys, like almost like Jeff Goldblum was supposed to be in Jurassic Park, were like coming out of the woodwork and just making really amazing discoveries too. But he finds the horror bent on that.
Well, I'll start with my favorite of the three, which was probably Prince of Darkness, just because it was kind of the most, I was like, I don't remember any of this, and it was the most surprising. And
I don't think anybody who went into that movie, especially the first time, knowing nothing about it, anybody could have gone in and said, like, oh, that was exactly the kind of tropey thing I thought it was going to be.
But it was sort of Carpenter's juxtaposition of science and religion. And kind of like, what if we accidentally found out that there was sort of the personification of Satan or evil that was on the physical plane?
Yep,
and
it may have been an extraterrestrial entity.
Yes.
Or that Jesus was an extraterrestrial entity.
Right.
But I guess by definition, this would be as well.
And we get a crazy priest played by Donald Pleasance.
Yep. But also kind of watchably. He's kind of like, if you were playing a Call of Cthulhu RPG, he'd be like the two-fisted priest you want on your side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was like the crazy psychologist he played in Halloween ready to blow somebody away with a pistol.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like he's like a few notches down in this.
That's who John... his name?
Donald Pleasance.
Maybe that's who Donald Pleasance
is. But let's be clear. How many psychiatrists do we know? For all we know, they're all like that.
I mean, it's Jesus. True.
Yeah, the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
But
he showed up late to his appointment, 10 minutes. So I blew him away with my 45 that I had in my pocket.
I knew he was not of this earth.
But in a lot of Carpenter's films, it's very kind of potboiler. You're people stuck in one situation, and they're kind of like trapped.
I mean, they are in this.
They're trapped.
No, I'm saying that was sort of a running theme for him. Yeah. Kind of like, what do people do under pressure?
Yeah.
Yeah,
The Thing is the classic example, but arguably even Laurie Strode was trapped in her sort of house in town.
Yeah. Right.
Real quick, the premise of, Prince of Darkness, it follows a group of grad students, like they're like physics, I guess, grad students.
They get pulled in by their professor, played by Victor Wong,
so
who's
good,
amazing.
He absolutely seems like an eccentric college professor.
Oh, yeah.
And the class he's teaching, when they show you a brief glimpse of it, I'm like, oh, that was such a juicy bit of lines.
Yeah, doesn't he like tachyon particles? And
yeah, he's like our logic collapses on the subatomic plane.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
his delivery is
so
amazing.
Good. But he is called in because he's been approached by a priest to look into this weird artifact they found. It seems ancient beyond ancient, and has somehow this green liquid in it, which could be some sort of personification of evil.
It's like the swirling, seemingly trapped thing.
Right, you're like, what could possibly be making it move?
Yeah.
Nobody knows, nothing, there's no perpetual motion machine, and this is a bazillion years old.
If I could have a prop from any of these movies, I'd want that prop.
Yeah. And so these kids set up bunks and cots and research equipment all throughout this old church that this thing is in the basement of, and begin researching it, and creepy things happen. There's also like a sense of weird stuff happening around them, like
Alice Cooper showing
eclipses, a very creepy homeless people outside who seem to be moving with direction, almost like, you know, there
it's
is
like
something.
They're a hive mind.
Yes, exactly, which fits in with the sort of insect imagery of like insects on the walls and
like
in some
worms
cases
on the windows.
A person whose body might be comprised largely of insects.
Of beetles,
in a very disturbing sequence.
And somebody gets killed with a bicycle?
Yes.
Yep, someone's murdered with a bicycle.
A lot of it is, though, the eerie atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's like, I would say in the last half hour, things go to shit.
Yep.
And there's a lot of kind of like, in the same way that, you know, sort of Jurassic Park becomes kind of about last-minute escapes and stuff once the dinos are loose, this has a little less of that, but it is the kind of a horror version of that.
But also the idea that, like, this imagery is being sent back through time in people's dreams.
Right, when you say the imagery, there's, like, a specific dream that everybody has, which is cool, because when they first start talking about it, they're like, there's a great oh shit moment of like, oh, I had that same dream.
We are coming to you from the
year 1999. Yeah. As this was made in what, I want to say like 87 or 88. Yeah. It was about 12, 15 years in the future, the far flung future of 1999.
Yep.
But yes, there's a weird mystery as to how are they being sent these dreams, and it's based more not in supernatural but in like the notion of possible science that somebody could use tachyon exotic particles. First time I ever heard the word, which even though it would become common in Star Trek and every other sci-fi property, but I didn't hear it until John Carpenter brought it up, to some essentially send back as a signal that would connect with people's like the electrons and stuff in their brains, a warning about some terrible thing that will happen in the year 1999.
There's just so many cool,
It's cool.
Do you think what they were warning us about was the Y2K bug?
Well, it did end society.
Yes.
But I definitely...
it's got a cast of his regulars.
Yeah.
The dude from Big Trouble in Little China is in there. And a bunch of other people, all of whom are very watchable. A
couple of cast members from They Live, because I was like, oh, it's that guy.
Absolutely. But you enjoyed it?
I loved it. I honestly think it's one of those...
Great soundtrack, too.
Great soundtrack. I honestly think it gets kind of lost in Carpenter's oeuvre in some ways. And people love the...
The same way something like his one upbeat movie, Starman, is kind of lost.
Yeah.
And Christine is kind of lost.
I'm just like, people should watch this.
But of the ones I just named, this is the best.
They Live, which I, again, hadn't seen. Great ideas. I mean... Yep.
It's based on a short science fiction story called, I think, 8 o'clock in the morning, which is a kind of neat little story. It's very short. Like, it's probably, like, 5 pages long. And I recommend people reading it.
And I don't think I would usually say that wrestlers are great actors.
Nope.
And I don't even know if Roddy Rod Piper was amazing in this, but he was the right choice for this movie.
Because, I want to say one thing. There was a bit in it where I was like, he actually has the capacity for acting. Do you remember the part where he's talking with Keith David? I think after they're recovering from stuff, maybe he had been nearly killed. And he talks about how when he was a kid, his dad, who used to like beat him or whatever, once held a straight razor to his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time when he's saying like, nobody's going to ever hold a razor to my neck again.
Yeah.
I'm like, his acting was pretty good there.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the same way that, what's his name, Drax, or... Yeah.
Dave Bautista.
Dave Bautista has come
the
around.
The material can elevate.
If you commit yourself...
Laurence Olivier never pile-drive Keith David into a bunch of garbage, and so everybody has their skills.
But the conceit of this is basically an out-of-work guy trying to sort
of... Blue-collar worker.
Blue-collar worker trying to kind of survive.
He's homeless.
He's homeless.
Yeah, he's homeless, yeah.
It's like a homeless camp run by good people.
Yeah, good people.
And he runs into Keith David, who's a good person.
Sees something occur at the church across the street.
Yeah.
And I love, by the way, stories where people get in over their head like that. Yeah. Kind of every man.
Yep.
And in this case, the every man is a giant guy who can... When he goes wrestler, he goes wrestler.
Yeah.
But he goes action hero.
The early stuff where the people in the church kind of randomly come out wearing sunglasses and are looking up in the sky, looking for, like, the helicopters. Or you're just kind of like, what the hell are you guys doing?
What story can they do that will tie these events together? But when I watch it again now, knowing what I know, it's still cool to watch because I'm like, I know what he's looking for.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of is... It proves on rewatch, like, there's more to learn, and the more you know, you kind of, it grows.
And these people, the homeless people, will ultimately learn that are threatened, just as the middle class is threatened by an alien incursion where they didn't take over and, like, raise our cities or anything. They integrated, and they became the capitalist rulers of society. They became the money men.
Would you call it a secret invasion?
And the neat thing is the glasses when you put them on, and one of the great sequences, and I'm going to say all of horror cinema
It's pretty great.
He realizes that everything that we watch, as far as like TV, newspapers, signs, and all that stuff, basically have subliminal messages that we don't actually see, that when he puts on the glasses, he literally sees in big, bold block letters the secret messages that... Like that
either obey,
consume.
Consume, sleep. Procreate.
Money, it says, this is your God.
This is your God. Yep. Some wonderful lines that he delivers as only he can.
Right, so there is a funny thing that happens is the movie could almost be mistaken for a somewhat serious sci-fi thriller for about 30 minutes.
Yep.
And once he figures out what's going on and has this moment, he becomes Roddy Piper.
Yeah, he goes on a rampage.
He kills a bunch of people.
He kicks the shit out of them. Lines.
Yeah. But famous, you, formaldehyde face.
The famous, I came here to kick to ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum.
Yeah.
I still like
There's never been a line that resonated for its like weirdness and badassery so much as that.
Yeah.
Except maybe some Bruce Campbell
stuff. Honestly, I love that line, but I also love the, you're okay. You're real fucking ugly.
His delivery on that is fantastic, and I think part of it is that Roddy Piper was known for trash talking.
Yeah,
he was perfect for that. And I don't know if they were using him or not, but I know that he like wrote out suggestions to John Carpenter on stuff his guy could say. And I have this feeling that that was him.
Yeah.
But also, it becomes kind of a there's some thrillers and intrigue stuff as they try and get into this without. Without being found out, culminating in essentially kind of an action sequence as they go after the TV station that is the predominant place to send out the signals.
Yeah. I would be remiss if we didn't mention Keith David.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the fight.
No, I mean, the fight is fantastic and goes on for 10 minutes, and I loved every second of it. But Keith David is just a badass. He is so good in this
He manages to be both genuine, but he's the guy who's like, dude, you are rocking the boat. He's like, I have just gotten my life in some vague semblance of order, and you're asking me to like risk it all on your crazy ass conspiracy shit.
Yeah, he's got a wife and kids back in Pittsburgh, and he's trying to support them, and things do not go well for these
people.
Keith
David is one of the great sort of natural actors.
Yeah, and Carpenter saw that, and he's in stuff now.
But we among the many things we owe Carpenter for is Keith David.
Yeah. And then the third and final film, which I had never experienced, which is Carpenter's love letter to Lovecraft.
Absolutely.
In the Mouth of Madness,
ways also a little bit of a spoof of Stephen King along the way.
Yes. In the Mouth of Madness is pure bonkers at times, but focuses on Sam Neill, who is an insurance
investigator,
investigating the disappearance of...
Like a Stephen King level writer.
Yeah.
Sutter Kane.
Who has disappeared on the eve, or pretty near the eve of the launch of his new book.
Yeah, and there's already some weird stuff going on because there's been, like, people are, like, so hotly anticipating it. It's got this almost, like, cult-like thing. You get a sense, they say there's been violent incidents at bookstores and things.
I mean, and Sutter Kane's agent attacks him in, like, a restaurant
Memorable scene. I love how it's filmed.
Great scene.
It is.
They're having lunch, and the camera is on them, but the camera's looking out the window, and you just see a guy with an axe just walk across the street very deliberately, hold it up, smash the window, and come in, and, like, does he kill the one dude?
No.
He doesn't. Okay. But he's about to, but before a cop shoots him.
Yep.
And he just does the eerie voice thing, which, by the way, I don't know if you ever noticed this. My brother pointed it out. It's a small special effect. But when he leans down and he says, do you read Sutter Kane?
Mm-hmm.
In this creepy voice, his pupils are slightly splitting apart.
Yeah. Oh,
as
yeah.
if, like...
That's happening to a lot of people.
I think because when I was watching it on a smaller screen back in the day, I never saw this on the big screen, I was just like, oh, what an amazing thing to notice. You've got a bigger screen. Probably more obvious.
A little bit. But it's also, like, the first point of transformation for people. As they're sort of devolving into... Or evolving, I guess, into kind of like the old one kind of creatures.
Right. And ultimately his search to find this guy will lead him on a sort of kind of crazy conspiratorial thing where he's like cutting up the covers of books to try and find these clues.
To form a map
to a city that doesn't exist or a town that doesn't exist.
With a weird church monolith. And
also a creepy, just the drive there.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of those things that got under my skin. I don't know if anybody's ever been out driving on a creepy country road with minimal lights and stuff like that. there's this dude he passes who's like a kid on a bike with like playing cards in the spokes making the
yep
thing over and over. And he passes him, and then like 10 minutes later or a few minutes later, passes him again.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, I'm always like braced for some creepy experience like that. And then there's it happens a third time, and he's like become like this creepy old man.
Yeah.
It's as if time has dilated and this kid has become an old guy.
There are several scenes like that where you're just kind of like, okay.
And that's on the more subtle side of things. There's also like practically like Village of the Damned, like, you know, like the Hall of the Townspeople turning. There's little glimpses of weird Lovecraftian tentacle things.
Evil children.
Basically once he gets to the town, things go into overdrive. And some of the reality bending stuff, especially near the end, is almost a little too much.
It is.
There's a little, you know, there's a few jokes I think that don't land, like playing the carpenters at the mental asylum he's at. I thought was a little bit of just a kind of a campy joke.
Yeah.
I was like, you're better than that, John Carpenter. But this was sort of, I think, late in the. I think it was the last very good movie
he made. As we like to say, he hadn't reached Ghost of Mars yet.
It was not Ghost of Mars yet.
He was on the road.
It was on the horizon. But look, if this is like, it's still a very good movie with a lot to like about it.
And Sam Neill grounds it as this. His performance is pretty damn amazing.
He's kind of an a-hole in it.
Oh,
he's doing. People who've seen Sam Neill knows he can play nice guys, but he's played a lot of assholes.
Yep. You told me on Peaky Blinders, he's like the world's biggest asshole.
Absolutely, he's he is a like special investigator for Winston Churchill in it, and he is like a fascist uber cop who will, you know, manipulate and burn anyone who gets in his way to taking down gangs and stuff in London.
But this also has one of the best last sequences of Sam Neill in a movie theater watching himself eating popcorn.
Yeah, it's weirdly creepy.
It is fun to see meta taken to its truest level, to the point where there is, like, not quite breaking the fourth wall. Like, in other words, I don't think at any point he literally looks to the audience or anything.
No.
But there is stuff where it's like he is within a fictional world. And realizes it, and he realizes he can be manipulated by the writer outside of him.
Yeah.
And it's a good ride.
But, so I watched two outings of Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy.
Right.
They Live is the third
Apocalypse
one.
Trilogy is just loosely.
It
was something that he described. They never, like, billed him this way in the theater. But it was, like, kind of especially
what interested him,
I think. Movies that kind of depict end-of-the-world scenarios. So the Apocalypse Trilogy is what, Nick?
In the Mouth of Madness.
Yep.
Prince of Darkness. Thing and Prince of Darkness.
Right. And those are, like, actually, when I think about it, a lot of his movies end with what could be the end of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Even Escape from New York, if people recall, he's got the president's tape recording that could be the thing that prevents World War III, and he is unspooling it and throwing that shit away.
Yep.
Great ending, by the way. But I'm like, feels like it's the end of the world again.
Yeah. I love his endings where you're just like, okay, well, things could topple into utter destruction and chaos. Or maybe it could go the other way.
Right.
But in the Mouth of Madness, you always feel like
the odds are stacked against them.
In the Mouth of Madness is not that. We're dead. We're gone.
Yep.
Prince of Darkness.
Somehow Carpenter's cynicism is like just extremely watchable, though. It's an energizing cynicism, not like just completely gloomy.
I feel like
part of it is a little bit of that sense of fun. I think he likes a good scare. He's actually quite good at jump scares. He will do cheap jump scares sometimes, and I still like him. But he always had a good thing with casting and stuff too. And I think like he usually has good scripts
and great music.
I mean, like Charlton Heston is the editor that's like gives him the job in that random good role from Charlton Heston.
Yeah, he was good in that. Yeah. I think that's it for us this week.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean we're gonna have more horror movies as we continue on
the list as always.
Yep.
But until next time,
Yo Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.